There's coffee and water in the back too if anybody needs coffee. Gave me the thumbs up. Okay, I'll call the meeting to order. Friday, July 23rd, 21, Sagebrush Ecosystem Council meeting. We are live and in person finally. After a long time, so thank you everybody for making the tour yesterday and surviving last night. And we will do this again next week, 30 miles to the east, so it'll rain again, so please mark your calendars. So because we are recording this morning, loud speak, it would help probably if you'd state your name as well. I'll do my best to recognize you with your name, but when you make your motions, we're going to try to make sure we do that so it helps with the minutes. Just keep that in mind. So with that, I'm going to go to public comment. Any public comment in Eureka? Public comment. How about on the telephone? Do we have any public comment on the telephone? No one on the phone for public comment? All right. Approval of the agenda. Is there a motion to approve?
So moved.
McKenzie and Swanson, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Approval of the minutes. Approval of the minutes for Tuesday, May 11th. You guys have a copy of them in front of you. Should have reviewed them. Any changes? Problems? Corrections?
Too long ago to remember.
Move to adopt.
Second.
Mr. Boyce, Mr. Mullaney, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Council member items and correspondence. Any council member have anything at this time to bring forward?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Mullaney.
For the record, Willie Mullaney, our group, Coalition for Healthy Nevada Lands, is working on the horse issue. We're putting together a letter to the Secretary of Interior simply to point out that we have a serious and urgent problem in Nevada and asking for their assistance. And it's in draft form right now. We hope to have it done probably next week, but we're going to try. What we'd like to do is get all the folks that supported SJR3 to sign on to that letter, which would be the council. So I know you need to see it. I just wanted to bring it to your attention, and I'll run it through Kelly. Maybe we can do that by telephone or a computer online.
Okay.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Along those lines with Mr. Mullaney, NACO, Nevada Association of Counties, is also in the middle of drafting a letter. I know because I'm drafting it, and we've made a few changes to it. It will also be ready next week. Ours will be going to the congressional delegation rather than the secretary. And we'll hopefully continue to get some traction on that. There is some appropriation movement on the House side, significant dollar amounts, it looks like, on the House side for the Wild Horse and Burro program. So we'll see if we can hold it together in the Senate, and we'll go from there. Kelly, do you have any correspondence? Okay. Discussion on updating and advancing priorities for implementing Nevada Strategic Action Plan to conserve and enhance the sagebrush ecosystem. Possible action. Mr. McGowan. Sure. So we'll do, we'll establish who is present. Mr. Boyce is here. Mr. Mullaney is here. Mr. McKenzie, Mr. Lister, myself, Mr. Gogachia, and Mr. Swanson. We are present. On the telephone, do we have any members of the council on the phone? Okay, so we are missing Ms. Lacey, Mr. M., and Mr. Biaggi. We have six of the nine. We have a quorum. Thank you, Tori. All right, how about now, Kelly?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. That was about 5 years ago. plenty of time for us to incorporate some of the new tools that have been developed to help us prioritize conservation actions within the state rep ecosystem. So I just want to, I'll go through these first few slides rather quickly. They kind of outline the roles and responsibilities of this body related to the state rep ecosystem. And so one is, of course, the thing that we probably have focused on the most since the program began, and that is to develop a mitigation system. So we've done that. It's developed, it's in use, it's stood up, it's operational. All of those that we're aware of that should be mitigating are mitigating using the CCS. So at this point in time, we have 100% compliance with folks using the CCS for their mitigation. Item B goes a little beyond that, identifying if necessary to prioritize any projects concerning the enhancement of the landscape, the restoration of habitat, the production of key non-native grasses and plants, and the mitigation of damage to or expansion of scientific knowledge of state rep ecosystem. Some of that we're doing, of course, the scientific knowledge. We have USGS, EI, environmental incentives, helps us to develop our tools within the CCS and expand on those. And USGS and other partners help provide some funding to develop the science that guides us. C is coordinating with federal agencies. Of course, we've since inception been doing that. It requests to consult with persons proposing to conduct activities in areas which include any habitat of the greater safe grounds that suggests changes to avoid minimizing the mitigation. Item C is solicit grants and private contributions for projects to improve the safe rep ecosystem. And then under NRS 232.162, again, in looking to the use of that science, establishing and carrying out strategies for the conservation of sage grouse and the sage grouse ecosystem in state, managing land, which includes those sage grouse ecosystems, taking into consideration the importance for those sage grouse ecosystems in the interest of the state, and then establish and carry out a long-term system for carrying out strategies to manage those ecosystems in the state using the adaptive management framework that we have in place. So, you know, the NRS gives us pretty solid guidance on what the roles and responsibilities of this body are. To date, I think we follow those roles and responsibilities. The first order of business was putting together a mitigation system, which we've done, as I mentioned. And so now I just felt like it was an appropriate time to pose the question to the council, where do we go from here? We've got the mitigation system in place. It's time to do the on-ground conservation that the statute requires of us. And so, slide four, this hits on the documents that we use. The three on the bottom, of course, are related to the CCS, the Conservation Credit System. The upper two are the forest plan and the strategic plan. A little bit of the population of state grouse, not only in Nevada, but region-wide. It painted a pretty stark picture of significant decline, as we're all aware of. But I will say that as far as mitigation goes, we have over 50 credit and debit projects that are active in the system. I think that that's a real milestone. It suggests that we have good participation on both those needing to purchase credits or offset their debits and those generating credits. So slide five indicates how area is areas in Nevada in which we have both of the credit and debits. You can see they're pretty well dispersed within the planning area. Today we've had 17 transactions. Those transactions encompass 4,000 credits that have been transferred and over 20,000 acres of conservation that are on the ground for 30 plus years. And then we do have a balance of credits that are out there that have not been transferred, and it's a pretty sizable amount. It's over 106,000 acres that remain in the credit system available for exchange or transfer. And as I said, we're kind of on an uphill battle. I think we all understand that. The populations, as Pete Coates presented to this body, it represents a region-wide population. There are a lot of factors that go into that. We try to mitigate some of those impacts through our mitigation system, but that's only for the anthropogenic disturbance system. So that's just one threat that we have within the sagebrush ecosystem. And you guys are all well aware of the other threats that exist, like fire invasive, wild horses, burros, ravens, and tending junipers, and so on. So the next couple slides, you've seen those before when Pete presented to you, talking about the probabilities of exploitation, not only in Nevada, but region-wide, and for both the short, medium, and long term. And slide. This is where I wanted to jump into the tools. So the bad news is, right, we have declines. Despite some of our better efforts, we have declines in population. We continue to have declines in the amount of acreage, mostly due to fires and invasives. We're going to keep our fingers crossed. So far, we've been pretty fortunate this year as far as fires go in Nevada within the sagebrush ecosystem. The good news is that we have tools. We have major tools that can help us begin to prioritize and put a little meat on the bone of this strategic action plan. So one of them is, indicating what are the best areas for fire rehabilitation exist. And DJ, where the most productive areas are the areas where DJ can be removed to have the greatest impact for safe grouse within the sagebrush ecosystem. We have an annual grass pool that we developed among the set to identify areas that can be prioritized for conservation action. Some of the other tools that we have that were developed by the USGS include the wild horse and burro population monitoring. We heard that populations in excess of AML create significant impacts within the sagebrush ecosystem, especially specific to the sagebrush. We also have a tool that indicates where ravens exist in densities greater than 0.4, and those areas are being heavily impacted by the influence of ravens. So we have some major tools for some of our major threats. We have PJ, we have fire invasives, ravens, and wild horse and burro tools. So part of our plan is to develop within the strategic action plan those tools to help people begin to prioritize conservation within their areas. And so that is part of our intent, is to update the maps and so on. I'm going to jump to slide 12. So essentially, the entire plan needs a section one to section three, I think there are more minor updates required for that. But it's when we get to section four, planning area prioritization and implementation guidance, I think that's where the greatest need for updates, collaborative efforts among all the agencies involved in the effort is really going to be necessary. And so within section four, that strategic action plan, it's broken up into five units. So the Waco, Lassen, MoDoc planning area, the more central planning area, the south central planning area, Elko, Lincoln, and White Pine planning area. And so each of those needs to be updated. As I said, this should be a collaborative effort among all the agencies. We need to incorporate the best science. There is a ton of science out there. It's almost overwhelming the amount of guidance that's available. So part of the effort will be to begin to digest that science and figure what of it is most appropriate for use in Nevada, and how can we implement it in a way that we can begin to prioritize conservation actions. So part of the vision in the updating of this strategic action plan, we think it should be adaptable and agile. That's the way all of our documents are. They all have adaptive management built in them. You guys have heard and acted on several improvements in that realm. It should be part of a very large effort. So this is our document that we need to update. I feel like this should be part of a much larger effort statewide. It incorporates the BLM, the Forest Service, and Endow, and anyone else involved in trying to conserve the state. And it should incorporate more than single species. Our focus has been on sage grouse, and some of the tools that we'll be using are focused on sage grouse and where conservation actions would be the most meaningful. But we also need to take into consideration more species in sage grouse. And so through our partnership with Endow and others, we hope to incorporate all of that to make it more inclusive so that we're truly addressing the issues within the sage grouse ecosystem. So I think it'll hopefully this type of planning and prioritization will provide some justification for funding. Whether we go to the state legislators or if there's some federal funding available, I'm hopeful that by having this type of prioritization, it'll help us give justification for any funding requests as we look forward. It should provide guidance to the local conservation groups. We hold an annual adaptive management process with the local groups. I think one of the failures or one of the shortcomings that we've had is, we give them some population information and some habitat information, and that's about it. And I think with these new tools, we're going to be able to develop a menu for them to say, in your area, these are the areas where EJs are a concern. This is the area where fire is invasive and so on. And so we'll be able to provide much more guidance to the local conservation groups. Not telling them what to do or where to do it, but just offering guidance where the studies indicate would be the most beneficial.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, go ahead, Ben.
You mind if I jump in? Kelly, can I? So for 20 years I've sat on the Lincoln County Local Area Work Group, and over the years we've identified a number of good projects and some really good ideas to benefit sage-grouse and sage-grouse habitat. The lacking, I guess the wish we've always looked for is financing and support. Some of the scientific support in making the idea work properly, But really funding is the large scale need at those local groups, and I'll just leave that on the table.
Brad, I agree 100%, and I'm going to take it maybe just a step farther, and I want to hear from from the council members, but not only should we give that an endorsement, but quite frankly, we need to lead that. We need to lead those efforts. We can be at the top of that silo, if you will. Kelly went over all the NRS at the beginning, and we've demonstrated over the last decade, this body's been in place for 10 years, that we can bring these guys to the table. And now, yeah, we know. We have the tools. We probably know better than anybody else, you know, what those threats are and where they are, thanks to these tools. And as that money comes in, and it comes into various groups, you know, if the Forest Service has something, the BLM does, NDAO, we're going to see more money available on that federal level for on-the-ground work. I really believe that in the short term, over the next few years, and this body needs to lead that. And we need to be not only telling the logs, hey, this is where we think you need to invest your dollars, but also our partners with some other money. Let's all agree that this is where we need to do it. So I agree 100%. I think that's what this plan needs to be updated to show that we'll be able to talk. Let me go to Jim, and I'll come to you. Go ahead, Jim.
Effort, whether it's collaborative, but it's not anything that any one entity can do on their own. If it's going to be successful and utilized, it's going to have the buy-in of all of the partners. And I urge folks to think about how they can add, you know, whether it's personnel or resources in order to make it an effective effort.
Mr. McKenzie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was my point of thinking as you were talking, Brad, in terms of, yes, we need to do this, and who's going to be the lead of that spear? And I know NDAO's started out as the lone voice in the wilderness, basically, on this, and we've learned that they tend to get disregarded, so I don't know if NDAO can lead that charge. I think our chairman's right that it has to be this council, because, I mean, it doesn't quite make it to the level of the governors, you know, through a series of governors. I'm not just pointing the one we have now. I mean, they say, yeah, we've created this council. And then it kind of goes away. They've got a lot of other things to take care of. It's not going to be a high priority for them. So I'm sitting here thinking, if it's DCNR or whoever else, I agree that the feds need to be involved. But as a state, what we can do, I agree with you completely, Mr. Chair. We have to, I mean, we've asserted some control in terms of regs and things. We've taken a little more dominant position. I think maybe it is our role. And going to the point in terms of manpower, you guys have enough to do what you're doing now, some kind of. But this would be a whole new, I mean, you'd have to add, I hate to say it, add to the bureaucracy, but we need more bodies to implement anything bigger.
Sherman Swanson, for the record, one of the reasons why I'm excited to represent the general public on this is because I think this body is a great opportunity for Nevada not to complain about what the feds are doing to us with so much federal land, but for Nevada to have a voice for what Nevada wants Nevada to be. And what I think it takes for that voice to be heard is for Nevada to put resources behind it. I think that Nevada should be requesting the delegation to fund the agencies, the federal land management agencies in Nevada, to have an adequate budget and personnel to do their job. And I think we could do that more effectively if Nevada put up matching money to match federal money to put projects on the ground. I think it's time that we go to the legislature with a vision so that we can have a voice, and the voice ought to be for this collaboration between the state and the federal agencies. Not that we are unfamiliar with that concept, but that voice for working together across the lands, across the land ownerships, private, state,
not very much of that, but BLM and Forest Service with NRCS support on public lands for EQIP funding, as long as it's going to benefit a permittee, they can do that. And that making the resource pie bigger is the justification, and the real focus of it needs to be on doing those things that increase the resilience of our ecosystems to the disturbances that are coming. Because we started this whole sage-grouse conservation effort behind the eight ball with the land predisposed for declining populations of sage-grouse no matter what we did. It's been an uphill battle, not because we have not worked hard enough, but because we were in a place where we had accumulated woody fuels, we had invasive species that are highly flammable, we had an emotionally charged wild horse and burro issue, we had a legacy of marginal funding to do the kind of work that it takes to actually get the vision of the public land, of the Federal Land Policy and Management Act and the National Forest Management Act and the Endangered Species Act and the Clean Water Act actually put on the ground in a way that they were intended to be put on the ground. And that is a great vision, but it needs us all working together to do it. And the question is the Nevada taxpayer capable of getting bought in through the legislature to provide a stronger voice for funding, asking for the federal voice by saying, and we're in this too, and here's our share of the budget.
So I'm going to go to Dan and then Steve. But you know, Sherman, you're bringing up some good points, and a lot of us in the room have met with a group just this week in Elko dealing with Lahontan Cutthroat. And, you know, they're trying to figure out, okay, guys, what are we going to do to get ahead of that one? And there's been some very candid personal conversations had there, and it comes right back to this. We don't want to be behind the eight ball with them. And they, that the group that, you know, they're social scientists and people like that, they're trying to figure out what to do there. They keep bringing up this body. What can the SEC do? What can the program do to make sure we get ahead of that, to leverage that money? So again, we're already moving. Everybody else is looking at us to move beyond sage grouse and to do exactly what you're talking about. There's going to be those federal dollars that I said coming, but we do need to match those. We need to leverage that. And there's going to be some state money, obviously. There's going to be some donor money. There's all kinds of stuff out there right now that we need to move. We need to update this so that when we go over the ledge, we can show that this plan is ready to go. And we're broke out into our five regions or whatever. We're getting, you know, if we end up changing that, fine. But we have some ideas. Give us the money and we'll put the shovel in the ground. Sam? Okay. Steve?
Yeah. You know, I'm fortunate enough to live in a place where I witness it day to day, populations, wildlife, and it's very frustrating when I see a couple sage grouse get up and there's no young birds in there, and that's what I've been seeing. But, and you know, with the threat of worry of ruffling feathers, somebody said it, we have the science. I'm not convinced we do. And I'm going to ask Endow, we're at a place where, are you comfortable, or are there ongoing programs that are really looking into the threats to sage grouse, possibly like West Nile, things like that? I mean, there's something going on out there. We don't really understand everything that's going on with those populations. I think that's one thing that'd be extremely important to do. On the other hand, in the last 30 days, I've been involved with two projects with the Fish and Wildlife Service, with their partners program, Susan Abel and her group, and we're actually putting fences up. We're getting something done, real things. And we have to work at this level, but until we actually are out there on the ground, working on that habitat, on that critical habitat, that's a huge thing. And it's getting done, and that's one program that's working. And I know Endow's been involved at a lot of levels with that, and I appreciate that. But, and if anybody's interested, I have pictures, and I can show you exactly what we're doing. One of them's getting finished up today. And but those kinds of things, and I don't know, Are you looking into things like West Nile and stuff like that, or are there programs? I would like to see a pie, how you guys feel the threats are, you know, whether it be wild horses, fire, whatever it is.
Yeah, Alan Janae, sitting in for Tony Wozlian. I would say there's probably as much research going on as on sage grouse as there's ever been. And so I know that they're looking into everything as far as West Nile. Sean might be able to give a, you know, assessment of that. I am not 100% sure, but there is more research going on sage grouse than there's ever been, and everybody's trying to figure it out. But as we spoke yesterday on the field tours, it's death by a thousand cuts. There's just a ton of things that are challenging this system, and it's not so much about what it is to the sage grouse, it's a matter of what's going on within the system. And so to the programs, you know, you're speaking about is you know, yeah, Partners for Wildlife, that's absolutely one. Endow has a private lands program, that's another opportunity. The work that we do with BLM on, you know, proactive restoration and Forest Service is, you know, opportunities to try to get ahead and try to address it before you're reacting in a wildfire situation. You know, in the past 5 years, Endow has, you know, done 466,000 acres of wildfire rehab. You know, last year was 62,000 acres. So it's we're running around and everybody's trying to get on top of this. And to Kelly's point and to this effort is like, yeah, we need to step back and we need to collectively look at the state of Nevada, the threats, the risks, the values that are on this landscape within the sagebrush system. All of us bring all of our information, pile it all together, and figure out where things need to be done. How people take that and implement it into their particular programs is up to them. And so Nevada Department of Wildlife, we started a year ago going through a process of that Sagebrush Conservation Initiative. We made that proposal to the commission. They were supportive. We're going down that path. Also within that is there's the Wildlife Action Plan. It's a 10-year update that we've got to do to our plan that outlines for all the species in the state. But the sagebrush ecosystem is a big piece of that. 350 wildlife species depend on this habitat. And so we're looking at that from this perspective. And I think there's a lot of opportunity. Kelly's aware of it. You know, we've had these discussions ad nauseum of how do we get together, bring information that's relative to BLM, Forest Service, Ag, Endow, DCNR. How do we bring that together, pile it all together, figure out where the priority landscapes are, and then how you take it back into any particular agency and implement that into your plan to guide your line of work, go do it. But I think that also, to Sherm's point of, you know, we can all stand there together once we've all got a common priority, we can stand at the legislature and go, this is, you know, we know this, and these are the tools that we're gonna use to guide this work, and we need more money to make more of a change in this system, in this state.
So I guess the question is then, how do we want to move forward with updating? Yeah, we're all agreeing. Everybody's saying the same thing.
Yeah.
So let's get to that. How do we bring partners in? You know, the program. Let's make sure they're
there.
The
one more point,
yep.
JJ, just that, but I think it's really important with these local working groups. Mm-hmm. I really don't think we've reached out as much as we can. And I know there's been some, but, you know, in our area, we've got a couple. And we're out there. Like Bevan said, we meet. We're the people that are actually making things happen out there or managing that area, whether it's cattle or whatever. So I think that's extremely important, and I really think there's going to be some federal funding available, and we need to take advantage of it. But that communication's got to be stronger, and maybe not just telling us what's available, but maybe we need to tell you guys maybe what. How we feel about it, maybe what direction we should take. So, get that.
Brad.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Brad Kroll, DCNR for the record. I'm not sure we are all saying the same thing. I think we're all agreeing on the scope of the problem and the need to do something. I'm not sure we're all saying the same thing in terms of the vector for effectively coordinating a broader effort. Alan, I hear what you're saying about enhancing current programs and making sure that they're strategically connected so we know what each other's doing and we're targeted in our efforts and we can go and ask for joint funding. But I guess what I'm struggling with is what should the mechanism be for having the interagency discussions both at the state, federal, and local level about where we're doing projects and how it fits into a broader strategic plan, that it's effective, that we're being additive, et cetera. I think there's some appetite for the council to be that entity. I'm not there yet, but I want to think about it. But there needs to be some coordinating and organizing entity to make sure that if we're going to take on a bigger picture effort, that we know what we're doing and it's not just promises to talk to each other.
No, I appreciate that. And I think where we've got to get to is it's not going to happen in this room. It is not going to happen as part of the SEC. It's going to be the agencies coming together offline, getting together, putting a focus to an effort to bring all the science and all the research that's been compiled and by USGS and by Fish and Wildlife Service and all the tools. It's going to take a technical group to go pull all of that information together and stack it in a very coordinated way to be able to depict priority landscapes. At that time, then they can bring it back to the SEC. Mm-hmm. NDAL can take it back to the commission. Ag can use it for what work they want to do. I think we've got to get to that technical piece and to think about who's going to do what. Right now, we don't even know what it's going to look like. And I think that there is a certain, coordinating piece, and we should all be pushing on it. My hope is that, I'm going to, be here, and Tony's going to be here, and we're going to be trying to push, the value of that prioritization tool within the SEC. But we're also going to be pushing through the Wildlife Commission to try to gain that momentum and try to push to get more emphasis and more money on this system. And so I totally agree, but I think that the initial step is it's not, unfortunately, it's not an SEC piece. It's not a committee. It's not a council. It's not a commission. It's taking all of our technical capacities and go sit in a sequestered area and pull all this information together, because it is overwhelming. The WAFLA is going through this process right now where they've been doing this for like 6 years of going through the sagebrush conservation strategy, and BLM is funding a ton of this work, and USGS is bringing a ton to it. And there's all these tools, and I sit in these meetings all the time, and I can't tell you the pluses and minuses of each tool, because they're overlapping, and it just is going to take a lot of scientific thought process to go through and understand the pluses and minuses of each of those tools. But if we can pull that all together, all of us, will gain the benefit out of that.
So I'm going to go to Bevin first, and then I'll go to Jim, and then around.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bevin Lister for the record. And Alan, I understand what you're saying, and Brad, I think I get what you're saying, and I guess I'm going to go back to, I don't know, 2012 or 13 or whatever, and the vision that I felt was put together at the time that this program and council was created, in that we needed a place not just to focus information, but to focus resources, to bring all of the best from the BLM and the Forest Service and NDAO and Department of Ag into a place, and the university system and NRC, anyway, the list, all into one place, and bring that science to a place where then the focus and the areas of best use of our resources to the benefit of the sagebrush ecosystem and in particular the sage grouse would happen from one place. Not that we gather science together and say, oh, well, you go do your piece with it, and you go do, because that's just a division and a continued division, and it's not going to solve anything. And I think it's incredibly valuable that this unit was created with that vision of bringing it to one place with a focus and a determination to make changes.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Jim Lawrence, DCNR. Just kind of tagging on to that. This is, it hasn't been set up to be the one place. My earlier comments was I'm personally less interested in developing paper, and I'm more interested in having the paper be utilized by the various folks that have responsibilities. And so I do agree with Alan. I don't think any council or commission or board can wrestle through all of the technical stuff that needs to be wrestled through. I think we need basically a group of staff from the different agencies working on what these strategies might look like. But it does have to come back up through, whether it's the SEC or the Wildlife Commission, federal processes, to make sure that it's going to be utilized. And I think, we're talking about the vector, what's the best way to do that. I don't know, but, I hear what you're saying, Alan, but what we can do is put together the document, and then it's kind of up to the different folks to implement it. I'm hoping for something a little stronger. I'm hoping that whatever is come up with, that there's enough buy-in at the front end, that it's not just, well, here, you guys do what you can, but that there's enough buy-in with this final document that it actually gets implemented. And I'm not sure the best way to do that, but I think that has to be kind of at the foremost, that there's going to be buy-in to get this implemented. And then the second thing, and nobody's mentioned it, how does this tie in with any upcoming land use plan amendments? Because not only do we have an uphill battle and urgency with what's happening in the landscape, but there's also going to be the political and the planning urgency of plan amendments possibly coming down. And I think that just even highlights the urgency even more to get some work done.
Thank you, Mr. Sherman. Mr. Chairman, Sherman's
Mr. Sherman.
Sorry.
I know, Mr. Sherman.
Sorry. I echo that too. I hate to take resources away from the ground to do planning and create paper on coordinated planning. Plans aren't worth much, but planning is everything. Because when people get together and figure out what to do next, they're having really important conversations. Mm-hmm. And my sense is that we already know so much that we don't need another plan to get started. What we need to do is get started, and along the way, another plan will come from it. But what we need first is to compile our ask out of those things that we already know is important to do, but we don't have the resources to do it. The Forest Service is grossly understaffed in Nevada and has been cut in its personnel through the decades, especially the personnel that are doing the bread and butter work on the ground of resource management. The same thing is true with BLM. Even though you've got maybe increasing staff through the decades, you've got so much greater increasing responsibility, you don't have the staff that's adequate to do the job that is now required by the NEPA requirements you have to fulfill in order to get that job on the ground. That takes more staff than we used to think was appropriate, because that staff was going to be a hassle for us. Well, now we understand that staff is essential to this collaboration process. We have these local working groups that have projects lined up that don't have the funds to put them on the ground. We have NRCS with the Sage Grouse Initiative that could do a lot in Nevada. What is their ask? What could they put on the ground? They're turning money back every year, but why? What is it? Is it because their staff is limited? Is it because the vision is limited and not adequately shared? I'm not sure. But the state agencies, NDAO, has generally not gotten much in the way of general fund monies. Most of the work that NDAO does is funded by the sportsmen, and that constrains their voice and it limits their resources. DCNR has not had very much money to implement a natural resources
vision for this state. And I think we could go all the way around the table and compile our ask and line it up with our vision immediately or very quickly. And I don't know any other group that's prepared to have that conversation than us. I don't think we've got plenty of work to do on our own. I don't want to create more work for us. On the other hand, we are the ones who now recognize that this big ask for state and federal and private working together is within our grasp if we simply have the voice to create the vision in others' minds.
Sean Espinosa with Endow.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chairman, for the recognition. Just a few things to, I think, explain to the group, just to make sure that, I guess, eyes are wide open here. But there is a big national effort regarding sagebrush conservation. Largely, that's being led by the Western Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies. Alan mentioned this earlier, but there's that sagebrush conservation strategy that's now turning into a planning effort. So just so you guys are aware, that could be a competing and duplicative effort. So whatever we can do to try and avoid as much paper as possible, I agree with, because we have created oodles and oodles and reams of paper on this subject, but we lacked implementation that's meaningful on the ground conservation. So that page needs to turn, pardon the pun. But to Sherm's point, you know, this is going to take a massive NEPA effort to be able to clear the types of acres that we need to truly make a meaningful difference on the landscape. And quite frankly, it isn't in the capacity of the federal agencies right now. When the three-bar EIS was being worked on, it took, was it 12 years?
12 years.
10 to 12 years to complete. However, Mining Project X got done in a year or less. So I asked the federal agency what gives, and they simply said they're paying for the NEPA. We're doing three bars on our own dime. So that type of model, I think, needs to change if we want to gain anything. And certainly the federal agencies need the help there. And just a few comments on some of the more successful planning efforts that have been very short. We've got the Bi-State Action Plan, which was like a 70-page document, but had some 80 projects that were identified initially in that, and some $45 million that were tied to that. That was a pretty successful effort. The North American Waterfowl Plan was 18 pages when it was initially drafted, and was a huge success story. We need to have something like that that's very simple, very effective, so we're not 2 years down the road with some type of planning effort. Alan mentioned this earlier. We're in the middle of revising our Wildlife Action Plan, which covers 380 some species of wildlife. A big portion of that, of course, as Alan mentioned, is the sagebrush biome. That's involved there. Tied with that is Recovering America's Wildlife Act. That could mean as much as $28 to $30 million to our state wildlife agency. So that's a big piece of the puzzle here. And I'll just conclude with a question that Steve had asked regarding some of the things going on with sage grouse. And, you know, we've certainly conducted our fair share of research on the species over the last 15 to 20 years. I'll boil it down to this. Over the last 30 years, we're seeing recruitment step down decade by decade for sage grouse. We took a look at mule deer fawn recruitment, and it is lock, stock, and barrel almost the same trajectory as sage grouse. So something is definitely tied with those sagebrush outlived species. I'm sure if we looked at what pygmy rabbit is doing and knew more about pygmy rabbits, we'd find the same thing. So there's definitely a change. in our sagebrush ecosystem. You know, our drought frequency is tighter. I'm sure you've seen the fire presentations where you have more drought, higher frequency, or higher amplitude of drought, followed by a very wet year, fire the next year, and it's just this wheel that continues to spin, and I'm sure that that's contributing to why our sage grouse and mule deer are doing the same thing on the landscape. So.
I just one comment.
Steve Boyce for the record.
So Sean, why we have some areas that are very pristine, they're in very good shape habitat, but yet we're still seeing a decline in some of those populations, and that's what I was that was the point I was trying to make, that there's threats that may not be tied to habitat. There may be some other things out there, and have we done what we need to do to research that and get some of those answers? I guess that's where I'm going. If I think there's other things in play with sagegrass. I'm not going to mule deer, but and hopefully we're looking into that as well as just habitat and what we can do. I'm not convinced there aren't other things going on that maybe we're not paying enough attention to. Could be disease, could be predators, could be a lot of things. That's my point.
Okay, so I'm going to bring us back full circle, and again, Brad says maybe we're not quite on the same page, but I know we're in the same chapter anyway with what we're talking about here. There is an agreement around this table that, yes, somebody's got to do it. Alan's right. It's going to take some very sharp minds and lots of staff to pile this together. But, you know, just like Chris said, it eventually does need to come back through here, because that's what we do. That's our body, and let's make sure that we're doing the right thing for the state of Nevada, for the public of Nevada. We can help lead that charge when we go to the legislature and say we need money. Endow goes and says we need money. There's going to be some barriers to that. Ag goes and says they need money. There's barriers to that. But us, with the statutory authority to do what's right on the ground, we can lead that charge and help this. We can leverage that, Recovering America's Wildlife Act money. We can help leverage that with some state dollars. Now, you guys get $20-30 million, and we might only have two or three that come through a general fund, but all of a sudden we're putting that stuff on the ground. We're helping get that NEPA done, because that is the biggest thing. I mean, I know Lance will agree. We can talk all this hot and cutthroat crap we want to talk to all day long. If we can't get the NEPA done, we can have all the pie-in-the-sky ideas of how we want to do it. NEPA's not done, and we can't get water moved to where it needs to be moved and infrastructure done the way it needs to be done. We're going to have another body just like this that's going to be dealing with the fish instead of the safe job. And we got to get ahead of that. So how do we do that, guys? What do we want to do?
Well, Mr. Chairman, for the record, Willie Mullaney, I think what you just encapsulated is right on the mark. We need to go to the legislature and get the state of Nevada to step up. And then we can match federal money and get something going. And I think you're right on. And so I support what you say. But that's what we ought to focus on.
Write that down.
That's a first.
Really supportive of what I said. We had somebody on the phone. Yeah, Ray.
Doing
Thank you, Ray. Dan.
Dan Huser for the record. I just want to speak to you a little bit. I agree with most of these statements and what Sean says, particularly with regard to kind of streamlined planning processes. You know, we have constantly shifting priorities, and so the market fire changed everything to some degree. And you know, the fires of the past are some of the places where work is chronically being done, and our populations are shifting as well. And so to build a pie in the sky plan that is infinite in its direction under constantly changing science, constantly changing priorities, and this wildfire regime that we have is I just want to speak to controlling the scope and aiming to control the things we can control, and writing something that is relevant to the amount of funding that might be relevant to this. And I do understand EQIP is always going to be, you know, to some extent eligible to all landowners in the state, and we can't control that program. That's just an example. And the Federal Service is going to, or the Forest Service is going to have some of their priorities and so forth, and endow specifically is going to have more of an esoteric wildlife focus than DCNR, and you know, so to some degree, I just want to make the scope implementable, or I mean, just being suggestive of that the scope is implementable, and we're not building something so big that it can't be implemented, and in such detail that then and that detail wouldn't change. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sherm Swanson for the record. I have a question for you, Ray, and I certainly hope I didn't throw any shade on NRCS. I did not intend to. I was wanting to include NRCS and in the list of agencies that could benefit by greater support. But I do have a question. If we had state resources for match, would it help NRCS get more EQIP money put on the ground, particularly perhaps on federal land? Thank you for your record of success and your vision for more success.
basically wrap around where we want to go, what this next step is. So Kelly, I'm going to come back to you, and I want, you know, where do we want to go, what do we need from this body to get there? Alan?
Yeah, I just wanted to, again, make a push that, you know, I know this council has got this decision of dealing with this plan, the strategic plan that you guys have, and, you know, we're definitely a part and a piece of that. But I really believe that pulling the agencies, the federal agencies, the state agencies together, to pull that, to prioritize the landscape so that we're all throwing the dart at the same target is a really critical piece. That is probably the, in my mind, that focus of knowing where we want to go. No matter if I'm working on Mahontan cutthroat trout, or I'm working on mule deer, or I'm working on sage grouse, is that there is a map that is put together by all of us in consideration of the best science and the best tools out there, that we can look at that piece of landscape and go, rather than doing something here, is by treating here, I can have benefit to multiple species, and I'm dealing in a habitat that is some of the better stuff. And so that's, I think that, you know, the plan is very important because that's the representation of it, and I believe that it ought to be succinct. But prioritization is, and this is the functional on-the-ground people, the biologists, the implementers, this is the piece that we need to do good work.
Mr. Chair, if I may, one more time here, Brad Kroll for the record. Alan, I think everyone here agrees with that. I think everyone does. The question is, how do we effectively coordinate those efforts amongst the state, local, and federal entities that do this type of work or have input into doing this type of work well? And I don't feel comfortable with a, you know, gentleman's agreement to for bureaucracy to talk to each other and work together. We've all been doing this for too long and are too smart to know that that's not going to work. So there needs to be a forcing mechanism. There needs to be a some sort of entity that can serve as a clearinghouse for multiple entities. I totally agree that the Wildlife Board, the Ag Board need to be brought into it somehow. But if this is gonna, how are we even gonna measure success if we're just saying everyone go do what they normally do, talk to each other and be smart about it? Like, we gotta have, there's gotta be some structure to make this effective.
Yeah, I agree is that they're, you know, in trying to keep people focused, that's, I agree. But I think what needs to be done is that piece of, we need all the agencies, we've done this historically, we can do this again, is commit to put your technical expertise on a team to sit in a room and get through this. How it comes back and comes through this board, that's fine. There's 350 species that Endow deals with that I know you guys aren't going to be worried about.
Well, wait, we're not talking species, Alan.
No, exactly. I'm talking sagebrush system, right. But I'm
all right. I
exactly.
Want to be clear on that.
Yeah.
And that's our statutory authority.
Yeah.
Yours is a species.
No,
ours,
exactly.
Quite frankly, is the habitat.
Exactly.
Okay.
And I sit as a habitat biologist within the wildlife division,
right,
or wildlife agency. And so, absolutely. But, you know, as we're thinking about that, as the Lahontan cutthroat trout occupy the riparian streams that flow through the sagebrush ecosystem, I need to, you know, that may not be something that somebody else brings forward. I would like to make sure that that's in there. How you guys use that, you may or may not use that, but it would be represented in the collective. And I think also to the locals is, you know, going to them and saying, hey, what values do you have on this landscape? And trying to capture that as well. But I think this prioritization piece is the key piece. And I, the conversations I've had with Kelly, I think that's, you know, I think we both agree on that, is the prioritization and knowing where we need to do this work is the biggest and most important step we can do.
Okay, Kelly, so how do we get there? How do we get to that? Yeah, everybody can come together, BLM, Forest Service, NRCS, Fish and Wildlife, TCNR, everybody comes together and, all right, guys, this is what we know. These are our threats. We know most of them. We have them here. Okay, so where do we go from here? We have to update this, but then how do we prioritize that?
So,
yeah, I'm putting you on the spot.
I'll put it tomorrow.
So
Monday.
Maybe.
Top of the pile Monday.
I didn't know that.
Sorry. Kelly McGowan for the record, and I agree with Alan. I think that one of the things that we can do as a set staff is to begin the process, to put out an invitation, to get the agencies and the specialists together, if nothing else, to just identify the priority landscapes. We can build on it from there, but I think that somebody has to take the lead. It would be ideal to come from this body to direct us to say, I know you're short staff, I know it's a bit of a tall order, but this has to get done. It is a priority. And so, you know, we expect you guys to kind of take the lead on this effort, to coordinate with the other agencies, to begin the process. How it plays out in the end, I don't think any of us, and I don't think any of us in this room are capable of hanging our hat on the wall and saying, we're the champion, we're the ones that made it happen, because it's going to require all of our very best efforts. And so it's not about that. It's not about saying who made it happen or who was responsible. It's going to be really important that it's a collective effort and that it serves multiple purposes. We'll update the strategic action plan. That's a part of our duties. We're required to provide an update, and it's needed. But I think the bigger picture is, let's get started on this prioritization. Let's get together with agencies. Let's get the science on the table, and let's begin to wade through. And like Alan said, we may have to sequester ourselves and just block off a week or 2 weeks to get through this. But it is a high enough priority that it needs to be done now. And so,
I agree with that. And I think, you know, we'd be remiss. One thing we're missing here is that adaptive management piece. And we want to make sure we don't lose sight of that. But that's still going to have to be playing there. You know, there's a guy in the back of the room that worked really hard on a couple of those when these triggers were hit. And, you know, Jake worked his tail off to help this group.
Yes.
Coordinate that and do that. And we can't lose sight of that, too, guys. Let's not completely pivot and go a whole different direction. Let's make sure adaptive management is given the opportunity to still work. But let's prioritize where we're going to be doing what on the ground. So that I'm going to be looking for someone to move in that direction in a minute to make that motion. I'll have a couple more pieces of conversation, but you heard what Kelly's looking for, and I think this body is in agreement from what I've heard. Steve and then Sherman.
Yeah, just real quick, but you didn't mention, we will never get to where we need to be without private land. Much of this is on private land, and we've got to communicate and educate and get out there and talk to those people that have all that critical land. That's all I'm saying. You left that out.
Sorry, I
didn't mean to.
Didn't mean to, sir.
Sherman.
So I'll perhaps help you out. Sherman Swanson, for the record. I move that we dedicate an upcoming meeting of the SEC to compile those core conservation areas and the information resources we have toward that end as a chapter with a section of the meeting also being dedicated to the needs for private land management that are not getting done because we don't have the resources to do it. What are those needs? With another chapter about the agencies reporting about the work that they would like to do, but they don't have the staff to do it for adaptive management, ongoing adaptive management. And the agencies compiling their NEPA document needs that, because they're unmet, are keeping them from doing important work. And additionally, those projects that they would like to put on the ground, but they don't have the implementation monies to do it. That list, more than just core habitats, but that short list, I think, compiled from our minutes from a meeting would be quite helpful.
So only Sherm could make a motion that was like 17 feet
long. I just wanted to make sure that...
that most of what I think Sherm said would go under item 11, but you know what we want to put on a subsequent agenda as well. We could probably do it there just the same, because that is definitely an action item. But were you going to second that?
I'm still processing.
Yeah, I think we're going to come back to Sherm.
No,
yeah, word for word, read that back.
Do you want me to spend the next half hour while everybody else is talking to write it down?
So I think we want to get there, but what I don't want to wait for an SEC meeting to direct these guys to get started working with Endow and working with the BLM and everybody else. I'm looking to tell them, all right, go. Work with partners, work with private land, work with Endow, work with Forest Service, BLM, today. When we come back to that next meeting, they might have an idea of, hey, all this is out there. The SCI or whatever we're calling it, Sagebrush Conservation Initiative. Here's where that is. Here's what we're looking at. We might know where that Senate bill that was introduced last week is going and how that $30 million starting to look. We're going to have a clearer picture by then, I think, of where we're going. So,
and part of my motivation on that is that agencies are not allowed to lobby for their own budgets. They're not allowed to lobby in Congress at all. But if we as a state entity ask them for a report about the work they can't do because they don't have the resources to do it, we can use that information to communicate with Congress.
No, agreed. And I'm going to be honest, because we're behind the ball when it comes to appropriations at the federal level. The House Interior Appropriations is already moved. So we're behind the ball there. We're way ahead of the ball for if it's the Nevada legislature we're talking about. So while we're talking about arguing for that money, this July and August isn't the time to be having that conversation.
I'm going to respectfully disagree with you one more time, Mr. Chairman, because we have a unique opportunity with state level funding. And sorry, Brad Cole, for the record, because there is CARES Act money, COVID relief money, plus potential infrastructure money that you can't count your chickens till they hatch money in the bank. But there could be near term state level money for wildfire ecosystem restoration, things like that. And we will have to lobby for that, because it will get eaten up by other agencies that have nothing to do with what we do if we don't figure out how to leverage it.
Yeah, we can get with Zach and figure out, because they're on their road tour right now trying to figure out what they want to do.
Exactly.
You're right, we need to be plugged into that.
Mr.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Jeff Lemire with Fish and Wildlife Service, the director. I really appreciate the conversation you guys are having there. I wish I was there. But I just wanted to kind of weigh in on our behalf. This is, in our opinion, very much needed for us to get more aligned. And I think that as a state, we've really done a great job over the years, but we need to get better, because as you mentioned early on, I feel like we are behind eight ball, and that distance between us and eight ball seems to be getting further.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, for the record, Willie Molini. I move that we direct Kelly and the SET to bring together the agencies to prioritize the habitats or ecosystems of this state to move where we need to go, as this whole discussion has focused. So with that, that's a short motion.
I have a question on that. I mean,
somebody want to second that first?
I'll second it for the sake of discussion.
Okay, thank you.
Start the discussion.
All right. Seconded by Mr. McKenzie.
I guess directing our SET to bring the agencies together, I mean, part of our deal is buy-in for everybody. And we all know we have representatives on this board that are based on interests. They're not necessarily based on affiliations with agencies. And we have ex officio members that I think is the beauty of this group, is that we get together and do get to have these discussions, and that's why I see this group being the vehicle for making this move forward. I mean, it's almost like we need agency members on the set, which is, who's going to cede that control? Well, I mean, everybody's worried about their own thing, and we all are. I mean, we agree we need to get it done, but we all have our own interests. We're worried about getting encroached upon. And so directing you to get the agencies to participate, is that something that can happen? Can you get the agencies to willingly participate and make that happen? And I mean, we can direct you all you want, but if you're not getting buy-in by the people that need to do it, we're pissing in the wind, if you will. So, I mean, is that something that you can do if we make that motion?
Chris, you mean the federal agencies participate in the state
yes.
set?
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, we have the state agencies on the set.
No, I know that. I'm sorry. I'm talking. I should have clarified federal agencies. And so, and that's my question. And is that something that can happen?
Well, that
it would be helpful to hear from.
That's where I was going. Yeah.
So we heard from Justin. That they will obligate themselves to participate.
So let me start with the guys on the phone. Justin said yes. Ray, you guys will make yourself available for this, I'm assuming. You have been on the phone?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Lance?
Yeah, Lance Brown for Forest Service. I'll say yes.
Alan Shepard for the record for BLM. I would say we definitely will be supportive of being part of the set if asked, and we have the, you know, being able to get in there with the manpower to bring our personnel into the discussion, because I think it's a valuable piece that we, the federal landowners, being the majority of the land that's going to be affected or is affected, that we're part of it. So we'll
so timing wise if the set wants to start meeting in the next few weeks and helping prioritize this, you know, we've got an Endow representative on the set. We've got Ag, hopefully someday back on the set. That they're looking for somebody. We got Lands. We've got Forest. So we've got everybody. And if these guys will agree, you have the bandwidth in the next few weeks to dedicate folks to doing it.
That will be the difficult part because of vacancies and things. But we will at least have somebody there to be representative of the BLM with state director support.
Can you get folks there that are like in decision making type of capacity? You know,
everybody can make a decision. Yeah. I'll be honest.
With authority or whatever, in order to kind of, because we've talked about time being of the essence.
And that'll be discussions that I have to go back and talk to the state director with of how we empower that person or persons that would be part of it. You know, that's good. That'll be the big discussion that, you know, I'm sure the Forest Service will be in the same realm. In Fish and Wildlife of how you empower that individual or individuals to be able to say, yes, we're in full agreement with that step.
With this recommendation. And then obviously it's got to work
yes.
its way through the process. But
yeah.
Do you need folks that are part of, you know, this first update that really does have some authority and say, yeah, I think this is something that our agency can buy into and start implementing?
Yeah.
And that's going to be critical for
Oh, I agree completely. I think it really is a step there, you know, not having people that can say, yes, BLM can do this, or yes, Forest Service can do this, with some assurance
yeah.
that it's, you know, legit all the way up through yeah. the agency.
Okay, more discussion on this, Bevan?
Just a real quick question. So is this much different than the science work group that we had during the development of the CCS? A pure question.
So I was going to mention that even without action by this body, we've gone through processes where we've coordinated different makeup of science work groups depending on what was being addressed, sometimes lands and realty, sometimes wildlife, sometimes permitting, and so on. And we've always had tremendous partnerships with the agencies that have provided feedback. So I don't think this will be an issue, but it is good to hear and to get the support that I think is going to be needed.
Jim?
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry to keep the conversation going. I know we have other things on the agenda. And this might maybe we don't have to decide this now, but I want to make sure that the team, you know, working with the agencies has the appropriate direction so they're not spinning wheels. Right now we have a strategic action plan that's broken into planning areas, and maybe we did that intentionally, but as we talked about, we know more and we have to get more science. Is that still the right format for this, or is there a better way to do that? That's one of my questions. Secondly, I don't want to lose sight of what Steve has been mentioning about, you know, do we have the science, do we know the reasons for population declines, because we're getting declines in areas that don't really necessarily have a lot of human disturbance. And so prioritization is key, because that's how we focus efforts and get money. But part of the prioritization, I'm assuming embedded in that, is that exercise of going through the PMUs and the planning net units and kind of really diving into population status and causes for decline and before prioritization. These are sort of the details that, you know, I think in order to have a robust document at the end that's utilized, and then, you know, it has to be vertically aligned with the region-wide federal processes and the local groups and all of that. So maybe that's something is delegated to the team of experts to figure out, but I didn't know if the council wanted to weigh in on those, you know, types of nuts and bolts types of things at this point.
Well, I think I'll start with your last point from my perspective, and that's why I brought up the adaptive management process. I don't want to see that go away. So if we get into these PMUs, what happened? We've got to stay with what we've been doing. Something triggered. Mm-hmm. So let's figure out how we're going to pivot away from that and make that not happen again and try to stop that. So I don't see our strategic action plan changing how we address that, and I see Alan Monty. I don't think you guys want to do that either. I mean, when we hit a trigger, we got to figure out what happened. We sit down and we allow adaptive management to work. I guess I'll want to hear from you guys, but I guess in my mind, that's what Willie had asked for. Let's kind of bring everybody together, compile it, and let those guys figure out the answer to your first two points and where we need to go and what we need to do. I still think we want to have it kind of broke out regionally. I know, you know, Bevan and I probably have a lot of the same threats when it comes to PJ. Steve doesn't have any of it. And that group up there is trying to figure out how to get some more late brood rearing and keep the ravens from eating them when they're younger. So I think the body would be wrong to throw out the framework that we started with. We want those logs. We need those logs. We need that on the ground, and we need it broken out into regions. So I see a lot of nodding. Okay.
Thank you.
Any other discussion on the motion before us? Did you guys catch who was?
Melanie.
Oh, no. Okay, yeah, go ahead. Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. Any other discussion? Kelly.
I just what I want to share with the council is one of the things that we can do is ensure that we take good minutes of these meetings that we anticipate holding with the agencies and send them to you folks to make sure that you know the type of discussions, the type of decisions that are being made, so that you don't have to wait 2 months until the next meeting to get updated. So we can provide that. They may be a little, sorry, Kathleen.
Don't look at Kathleen, she's glaring at you. Just keep talking and moving.
But I think that we can certainly do that and provide you with that information as we kind of make our way through this process, okay. Planning process.
No, that'd be much appreciated.
And we can use the feedback, I'm sure.
You bet. So. Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Any opposed? Motion carries. Okay, so as we move on to the next one, I guess I should have done this when we started a little housekeeping. Facilities are down here. If anybody needs to use the restroom, down these stairs there's a set, and you can go upstairs and there's another set immediately behind that projection booth as well. So if anybody needs to go, just get up. Go. We're probably not going to take very many breaks so we can get done today. Number seven, review of revised
Okay, put my glasses on. For some reason, my eyes are blurry. I need some eye drops for some reason. Those two guys get it. Review of revised improvement to the conservation credit systems manual of the following. Appeals process for certain decisions made by the administrator in carrying out program regulations and CCS policies, and propose edits to pertinent sections in the CCS manual. Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kelly McGowan. This will be brief because I do need to use the facility.
So do I. Do we want to take, do we want to take 60 seconds? Okay.
I don't want to.
Mr. McKenzie has to go.
I'm all right. I'm more worried about
5 minutes.
I might be Mr. McKenzie. I'm fine.
Now, I'm going to go to the right.
You're going to go down? Okay. Watch your head. It's got me more than lost you.
Got me.
All right, we're there. I've already introduced it, so the agenda item, so go ahead, Kelly. Item 7.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kelly McGowan for the record. This is an improvement that you all saw at the last meeting. There were some minor edits and some other changes that were recommended by this body. So those have been made to the document. I'll just point out where the changes were made, and then probably the most significant item that was changed within it. So sections 2.1.1 and 2.1.9 and 2.3.3 of the manual, the conservation credit system manual, have been updated to or will be updated to reflect these changes. The whole meaning behind this improvement was to give this body the ability to hear appeals, essentially, or disagreements, and so hopefully the changes that were adopted or that are proposed in front of you meet that. So I think Mr. McKenzie had an addition to add not, but that's on page 2, line 20. So we added the added that word to make it more
legal.
Yeah. And then we had a comment from the public on page 2 also, line 22. So initially it was just addressed as mineral development, and so we changed that to include essentially disturbance. So that it doesn't single it out. So that change was made. Council Member Biaggi asked if within the document was there just an overall statement that gave this body the authority to hear appeals. We did find in A54 within the document that there was a resolve outstanding dispute statement, but the problem that we found with that is that it's on line 31, page 3, it really spells out that it's to resolve disputes between participants, and so we wanted to broaden that to not just be disputes between participants, more than likely meaning a credit buyer or a credit seller that may have a dispute. And so we broaden that language to essentially encompass anyone that has, you know, a disagreement or a dispute can bring it to this body. We still have a language in there that they can request a hearing or request that it be heard in front of this body. So essentially, though, that was the most significant change, was to delete section A54 within the manual. Now it refers to section 2.1.1. 2.1.1 essentially says that this body will resolve policy and regulatory disputes that cannot be resolved independently or in consultation with the administrator.
Mr. Chairman.
Is that it? Anything else you want to add before I go to questions? Okay, go ahead.
Just a quick question. So the use of the term oversight committee, instruct me, is who is the oversight committee?
This body, the Sagebrush Ecosystem Council.
It's defined, not in this, but I think it's defined.
In another place? Okay, and that was kind of where my question was. All right, thank you.
Other questions on this? Chris?
Sorry, Kel. Page 2.1.9, we had that new language on the second sentence. It says examples may include but are not limited to. Shouldn't that be a colon rather than a semicolon? I think.
Very possibly.
Sorry, little stuff.
Makes it a pause. I'm gonna tell you, it's so quiet. This is what he comes up with.
Yeah. You know, I was bragging on last night. I was telling people, man, McKenzie's so smart when he speaks. You know, he's well put together, very articulate. I was bragging about you. I think I was anyway. And that, just like Brad said, that's what you come up with.
You can have a whole litigation over something like that.
And there it is. I would like to compliment Chris on the fact that he was able to make that comment without using a single legalese word.
That's right. Okay, so that edit, we'll make that a colon instead of a semi.
Sorry.
I did go back and forth, and I didn't catch it. Is it a semicolon?
Yeah, there
we go. I complimented you on a good job before.
All right, we're getting stuck in the mud. Anybody else have anything on this?
Move for approval. With the inclusion of the colon.
Mr. Lister has moved for approval. Is there a second? You bet. Hey, give me 1 second. Can I get a second for sake of discussion and moving forward, Willie? All right, go ahead.
Say ye, Kelly.
So, we'll perform a word search within the document. We can add to the glossary a definition if necessary. If there is some distinction between performance manager and performance standard, we'll be sure that we cite that in the glossary and make sure it's used properly.
That works for you, Justin? Any other discussion on the motion? All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Chair votes aye for the record. All right. That's it. Review of draft policy concerning mitigation for permitted activities prior to December 7, 2018 and require a permit renewal exclusively for an extended term. Dan, is you?
Yes. Dan, okay, user for the record. So this one's pretty cut and dry. Aims to clarify policy concerning mitigation for permitted activities prior to December 7, 2018 that require an extended term. And so December 7, 2018 is the date listed within the regulation upon that all actions authorized afterwards are to mitigate. In the CCS, and so what occurs for what mitigation is required of renewals that move forward prior to that date has kind of
require periodic renewal, and there's going to be a number of them, and you know, and so many, many disturbances occurred on the landscape that were authorized prior to this date. And anyway, our recommendation for an improvement is to add within the manual under 2.52 debtor project types, an activity project which was approved by all relevant federal agencies and state agencies before December 7, 2018, so long as the activity or project maintains compliance with any condition or requirement for any such approval. Authorized impacts activities that were approved prior to December 7, 2018 will not be required to mitigate if the renewal is exclusive to an extension of term. And so, should the project require NEPA to alter the authorized project, project boundary, or propose new activity or disturbance, the project may be subject to mitigation for those proposed activities. And so that has been the precedent to date, that all alterations to historic projects are mitigated, and expansions. We see mine expansions, and have seen those in the program, and yet there's also these things such as county roads, power lines, pipelines that intend to be on the landscape for a long period of time and do require periodic renewals. You know, we believe this is the most practical way to approach it. There would also be a lot of tracking involved, and in addition, we believe this was the intent of the regulation to begin with.
Any discussion on that? Someone make a motion to approve. Alan, you want to discuss first?
Very quick comment. Could you just scroll back up? Just to the language, and I thought some clarifying language might be is mitigation through the program, or some clarifying language there, because there's still a requirement that they may be mitigating through some other, you know, previous commitment. And so, yeah, I just want to not let somebody come and argue that point. This allows us out.
Thank you for adding that clarification to our clarification. Maybe subject to mitigation through
the program, through the SEP. Okay, that language, that will be amended to include that.
Make a motion to approve with that change.
Second.
Kinsey moved. Mr. Boyce seconded. Any more discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 No way. Forget it. Yeah. You needed to be here for the barbecue in order to provide comment on that.
We needed more rain.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Justin, regarding 252, there is some housekeeping, and so there's going to be a passage moved down to make it fit. It didn't quite fit in the above section, and so there will be some additional housekeeping that is, simply edits that don't change the meaning of anything, but better organize those passages. In order to simplify it, we didn't present that here. Regarding policy, there's many things in the policy stems off the regulation. There's many things that aren't, for instance, the HQT and what that was our feeling. JJ's nodding as well. Regarding EVA, you know, that is, we often use NEPA as a filter to that's kind of as a filter for different projects and to determine those and seek to move forward from there. And so I guess that is a simplification from what is in the regulation. Katie, you got anything?
I'll just add real quick, Justin, for clarification as well. We went around and around on this, if you guys remember, a while back, and when we know, and when the team knows that something is happening, and it was NEPA, was what we came back to with the help of Mr. Raby at that time. Well, there will be a notice, and that's when we get alerted as the program that something is happening. So that's why we went with NEPA, as far as that was the trigger, that we needed to get involved. If it didn't go there, there's a lot of these things, just as Dan alluded to, that we didn't know about. I mean, if it was a simple renewal, we had no way of knowing. So that's, we went to NEPA, I don't know, it was several meetings ago when we had that conversation about what it was gonna take to alert us and to trigger us that something was going on. And so that notice of intent, if you will, then that triggered us that we had to get involved. Or similar state action.
Or those words that Justin voiced that we have elsewhere.
Do we want to hold on this then until we get some tighter language that may and run it by them? I mean, I think we all know what we're doing. If we got to wait 30 days or 60 days to get this right and they're comfortable with it and we're more comfortable with it. Okay. So we have a motion and a second. I'm going to recommend that we go ahead and vote it down at this time, and then we'll bring it back for other language that's cleaner for the minutes. And so I think that's the path we're going.
That makes sense.
Good. All right. So all in favor of adopting this language, say aye. All opposed?
Aye.
Aye.
Nay. Whatever. Nay.
Aye.
Okay. So it's voted down, and we will bring it back for, and let's make sure we run it by Justin, too, and that they're good with that, because it makes sense.
Yeah.
We didn't think about it.
I appreciate that.
Good catch, Justin. You're still not off the hook for not being here last night, though. All right. Oh, we're going to do it again next week, because it rained. So. Staff briefing.
Excuse myself. I apologize, but I need to get back to him. Chris has my proxy.
We get some shit. Now we're gonna roll.
See, it comes out better than a semicolon now.
There you go. All right. Thanks, Director.
Thank you.
I'm this driver.
Staff briefings to the council, possible action, mitigation requirements. Ensuring proponents are aware of the potential that mitigation may be required regardless of the type of NEPA, size, or location of a proposed project or a proposed modification to an existing project. Do we want to address this now, or do we want to put this off as well based upon what we just did? And so that this item matches up with what we just agreed to change. What do you want to do?
So I prefer not to put it off.
Let's go then.
Katie Anderle, for the record. Yeah, I think holding off on the improvement of the renewals is just a clarification on policy. It doesn't actually change how we're addressing new proposed services. So I don't think by not adopting this improvement will have any bearing
on discussing and
making a decision on this agenda item.
Okay. Charge.
Yes. Thank you. Kelly McGowan, for the record. So the main reason that this item is on the agenda agenda, and it's kind of been a standing item on your guys' agenda, is to provide you some updates and some idea of the types of challenges that we're facing. We'll get to the letter after this agenda item. But essentially, this is, we have about a dozen projects that we have been failed to be notified of. Many times they're fairly simple projects like DAs or DNAs. And so that creates a problem for both us, for the authorizing agency, it creates an issue. And it also creates an issue for project proponents. Because if they go through, even if it's a simple NEPA process like a DA, and they get to the end of it and they're authorized to move forward, and then we come in at the last minute after finally either through our state clearinghouse or whatever notification we receive it in, we say, hold on, you need to mitigate first, and you need to have your mitigation in place before you break ground. That's a real problem for, like I say, for both agencies and especially for the project proponent. So, like I say, we have DAs associated with mine expansions. We have three tower projects that fall into this category. We have a solar complex that falls into this category. And let's see, and potential expansion of a mine and one for geothermal. So we have a number of projects that either we were notified late in the process, we weren't brought in during the scoping period, or we were left out at the end of the process and weren't given notification that they were being authorized a notice to proceed, which is under agenda item 9B includes one of those projects. So I just and I've talked with Alan about this a little bit. We're going to work with the state office and the field offices to make sure that our information packet that we've sent out to the district offices are really clear about this, that regardless of the NEPA action, we have an MOU in place that says you will contact us, or you'll have the project proponent contact us to ensure, you know, that we're involved in this process from beginning to end. Number one, it's important because our hierarchy is avoid, minimize, and mitigate. And if we're only being brought in during the mitigation, that's an issue, because we need to be exploring ways to minimize the impacts of these projects. So it's more of a clarification. I wanted to say that we have a number of projects that are kind of slip through the cracks. I'll accept some of the burden that maybe we haven't been as direct in our conversations with some of the field offices, but I just wanted to let you guys know that we will be updating a letter and along with a packet of information that they give to the project proponents. Mm-hmm. That hopefully, you know, lessens or hopefully eliminates the problem of some of these slipping through cracks. And so that's just wanted to make you aware of that.
And if I can weigh in, you know, something does have to be done. I mean, Kelly and I were discussing a project in the Elko District just the last 2 weeks, and Kelly wasn't even aware of it when I first brought it up. I mean, there'd been some rumblings. It's an oil well, and we all remember an oil well in another valley not very long ago that is still a disaster that we're dealing with. And so we were trying to avoid that. Eureka County did comment on this one, and I did CC Kelly on there, so he was aware of what our comments were and were going on. So something is falling through the cracks somewhere, because the county was invited to participate, and yet the program wasn't. So we need to figure out something and tighten it up a little bit, because we didn't. That you know, there's like 12 miles of two-track road is going to be upgraded,
improved
in this one, and there's some big potential impacts.
This question, I mean, Alan, how does that work? I mean, when you're working on NEPA and the permitting process, there must be a list, a state list or something, you know, NDOT, NDEP. How do we get on that list? I mean, how how can we ensure that we're part of that process?
Well, I would say in theory, the SEP should be on the list, in the mail list for notification of different things that are being developed, whether if it's an EA or a DNA or a EIS, through that whole process. And then I think in that meeting that John said that it would be the best way is to through the notification process of the the notice of implementation, or what is it, notice of availability and all those things for that document. That would be the where we start NEPA. That should be where the SET is reached out to and notified, just like the county governments are, the Fish and Wildlife Service, everybody else is brought into the mix at various stages, of course. But when that document's really being developed, that's the first foothold that the stakeholders should be involved. And I think that's where, when Kelly and I were talking the other day, it seems like there's kind of a hit and miss on when, you know, you get the SET gets it on some projects and does it on other projects, and then all of a sudden finds out at the middle. And I think that's just coordination that we at the state office for BLM have to communicate to our planners, our field managers, our district managers, that there is a step here that we need to make sure that's occurring on some of these big projects, particularly that, you know, have an impact, you know, in sagebrush country or any type of resource. It's just going to be the, you know, retelling them that, you know, there is a step, you know. And we've got a lot of new managers, we've got a lot of new planners, we've got a lot of new staff that, you know, may not realize that step is there, but for whatever reason they're not seeing the, you know, I hate to say the mail's getting lost, but you know, those notifications for whatever reason are not going out, where in some cases you get it all the way up to the decision, and then the decision notification is not received. So I think it's just re-educating or re-telling folks that, hey, there is a box to kind of check here of making sure things are done.
Just a quick question, Mr. Chairman. So in process, Alan, if I go to Yelko District and I file an application for a mine,
yep.
Do they automatically notify the state, or is there a point that they notify the state? I'm wondering if it's an issue about different districts.
I think it is, and I think it probably will come down to clarification of the role of when that should occur in the process. You know, is it in a sequence of events where, you know, the application's received, okay, there's check one. What do you know, in opening those discussions with the proponent, okay, by the way, you know, you have to do this step. This is a state requirement. You know, just like reaching out to the state mine folks. You know, here's a step here, you know, that they have to follow through. And I think it's just, you know, the outline of, you know, bing, bing, you know, checking off those check marks to make sure we did this, we did this, we did this, we're good to go, type of thing. And then we could start the roll of the process. And I think, like the Kelly and the SET, you know, just refamiliarizing yourself with the new managers, the new officers there, you know, just getting that packet out there. We'd really appreciate you following, giving us the early warning as possible. I think that'll be a big deal. And once I know that went out and is ready to go or something, you know, I'm sure John or I can bring it up on one of our leadership team calls, just reminding folks. And it might be a point at some point if there's issues or conversations that need to occur, we could probably have, you know, maybe Kelly give a little short presentation at one of our statewide meetings or something like that, just to kind of maybe have folks ask questions, you know, why they have to do it, how come, you know, what is the next steps or whatever.
And this is a conversation that we can have off the record, but I there was a point in time where I believe you guys have quarterly or meetings with your field office managers. And I will request again that maybe that might be an appropriate time because of the turnover issues. We don't know when you have turnover and when the packets need to be redistributed. But if we were a part, and you know, we could just be a part of that meeting at the beginning and then sign off and let you guys conduct your business. But I think just to kind of reiterate here any concerns that we might be having about a particular project from a particular field office and vice versa, I think that that would be helpful in kind of closing that that gap.
Yeah, I think we can sit down and have that conversation, and then we could talk to John and see how he wants to approach it, whether if it's at one of our monthly expanded meetings or a special one or something like that, just to get the process down right.
Okay. Under discussion? All right. Thanks for keeping on top of that and moving ahead. Let's go to B, Big Ledge Mine Closure Mitigation Status Review of Unmitigated Authorized disturbance associated with the reclamation of an inactive mine to address existing environmental impacts. Review of the first letter to the proponent and adherence with non-compliance notification policy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kelly McGowan for the record. So this is one of those extreme examples where something fell through the cracks, essentially. We have been working with NOV for over a year, analyzing, they ran the HQT, they knew they were gonna have to mitigate for this disturbance. They have been very good in working with us. This is a kind of an odd project because it's not a mine. The mine's been closed, it's been inactive for a period of time. But there are some acid leaching issues that are getting into the watershed. And so it is a really high priority for them to address this environmental impact. So they've been very good. But here, what happened is, regardless of the involvement and so on, they were issued a notice to proceed. They began construction. No mitigation has taken place. The letter or the email that I forwarded to each of you from their attorney, their representative, lays out that they have every intention of mitigating for this disturbance, and they intend to mitigate it fully. The reason it's being brought to your attention is, despite all the best efforts, they are technically out of compliance because they've begun the construction process and no mitigation has occurred. We require at least a third if they're going to phase it in. If they do decide to phase their credits in, they're required to purchase a third of those credits up front, and then a 5% penalty is assessed on the remaining balance. It doesn't accumulate over time. It's just a flat 5%, so it'd be 5% increase on the number of credits. Anyway, so this is, you got the email from the attorney from NOV stating their intention to fully mitigate and possibly even provide an agreement to purchase credits from a particular credit developer. And this is, in our process, I also forwarded this to you. We have a formal, four-step process that we use for those not in compliance. This is the first step. It's the issuance of a letter notifying them that they're not in compliance. So.
Questions on this? Comments? It does look like they have agreed to go ahead and purchase the credits, and they're waiting on signatures, correct?
Correct. And so here's... And it may not be action that can be taken right at this moment, but if this comes up again, I think we need to have another policy in place to what happens when they're out of compliance. Is there a penalty or a fee for that? And so that's another one of the reasons why we wanted to bring this to your attention. It's currently on the authorizing agency to not authorize, you know, the notice to proceed until they get the letter from us saying that mitigation has been completed, and that did not happen in this case. And so it's really through no fault of NOB. They issued a notice to proceed, and they proceeded. And now they're, but they are out of compliance.
So when you say no penalty, but yet, you know, step four says the process will be halted. I guess we're at the mercy of the authorizing agency to halt that. We say it'll be halted, but if the Forest Service or BLM or whoever it is doesn't make them halt, then really they don't have to halt, correct?
Correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Katie Anderle for the record. The first step in the noncompliance process procedure, as you know, Kelly stated, is this letter, right? So we're describing to the proponent what the regulations state and their obligation to mitigate. And if a resolution is not, resolved this within 30 days, then that's when we proceed to the next step and try to pursue more, coordination with the authorizing land management agency to potentially pursue, a stop order or something like that. So the proponent has proposed, an agreement to purchase credits, but those credits aren't available yet. They're not quantified. So I guess the discussion for this particular project should kind of revolve more around, do we want to accept the fact that they're planning on buying credits that may not be available until, 6 months from now? And I think ideally the way, we should be proceeding forward is to encourage them or to try to get the proponent to purchase the third up front, which is the regulation or policy in association with the regulation, and then the remaining two-thirds, that can be phased in over 10 years. So that, that could be completed at whatever time frame down the road. So I think that warrants some discussion, because if we decide to say, okay, you have this agreement, to purchase these credits, it could be a year or more before they actually get any mitigation implemented. So that's just one thing I wanted to mention for discussion. Thank you.
Steve.
Yep.
Sure, Brent. So why don't you go ahead and we? I think there might be some other questions or comments here, but we'll go ahead and give you the floor at this time if you want to give us an update and some more clarity.
What we're talking
approved, but that process has already been started, and we are committed to expediting that process as fast as possible. And the other thing that I would mention to the committee is that under the terms of that agreement, we are funding, there will be a lot more sage grouse credit and habitat set aside than we are going to purchase. And so the net effect will be sage grouse habitat preserved beyond the needs of this project that will be available for other credit use down the road. So I guess the point, and I'm happy to answer any questions, but the point that I wanted to leave with the committee, and I really do appreciate the cooperation of Mr. McGowan and the committee in hearing us out and inviting us to participate in this discussion. We do appreciate it. We're absolutely committed to being a good partner here. Don't want to get crossways on the applicability of all this. And so we fully intend and have stated that in writing to mitigate according to the sage grouse credits that have been assigned to the project. And we have been working very hard to get this agreement done. It's just taken longer for a lot of reasons than we would have liked, anybody would have liked, but we've got it done. It's fine. And the only gating item now is just to get those sage grouse credits approved. And like I said, that process is underway. We've already retained a consultant who's already filed the beginning paperwork, is already doing the field work. I believe in the next week or less than a week, they'll be submitting the calculation package to get the process rolling. So we're well down the road on that and committed to seeing it through. So with that, I'll stop. Answer any questions the committee has. I did want to make sure the committee understood what our intentions were fully.
All right, thank you. Questions, comments? Steve, still have something?
Yeah, just, and I am familiar, part of this operation, and I will say right up front is a reclamation type project and a cleanup project that is extremely important, and NOV has been, from a layman's landowner neighbor, has done a very good job, and we're very, very lucky that NOV is involved and not some prior companies that have been involved. So saying that up front, NOV was aware of the credit obligation mitigation requirements, and I think we have two things going here. We need to deal with this time issue, because this won't be the last situation we get into this if we don't deal with this 5% time thing. So we need to deal with that, I think, at least start the process today. As far as NOV, there are credits available. These ones that we're talking about right now are actually on the property where the work's being done, which it makes a lot of sense. But there are credits available in a very close proximity that they could purchase today. So, I mean, those two things are at play, and how we want to proceed here, I'm not sure. But to me, there's credits available. If it's a third, maybe they should buy those, possibly the remainder from that landowner when they're available. We've talked a little bit about that 5%. We need to put a timeline on that, whether it's 30 days, whether it's 3 months. Something has to give there. So, I mean, we can't just say 5% forever. I mean, that's just not going to work. And so we got a couple of issues here. And I don't know. I would be very interested in the SIP's comments on it and where we're at.
Yeah, Katie Enderle for the record. So just to give a very brief overview of what policy we do have and we're operating under is that the third of the credits, you know, have to be satisfied up front. It could be a half, it could be three, it could be whatever number, right? The remaining debits that are being phased in at a future date would be subject to a 5% phasing factor. So I wouldn't go as far to say it's a penalty. It's to incentivize more of the mitigation to be completed up front. And if a proponent, you know, needs to phase it in for, you know, financial reasons or whatever, you know, that's why we have that option. So this presents an interesting situation because now we have all of, you know, none of the mitigation has been done up front and the construction has started. So do we apply the 5% phasing factor to the entire obligation because none of it was done up front? Or do we still just apply that to, if they were, I know the proponents intending to purchase all of their credits at once. But, you know, if they, say, were to purchase a third tomorrow, you know, would we apply that phasing factor? Or would we just apply it to the remaining two-thirds? So there's, this timing issue is really important, and we don't have clear guidance on that other than that 5% is applied to the obligation that's not satisfied up front. So there's a few different issues that, you know, we have to discuss. And I think, you know, we probably won't come to any sort of conclusion today, but I think it's worth, you know, us pursuing different options and maybe presenting to the council, you know, different scenarios and how to handle certain situations. Because there's so many different avenues we can take.
There's lots of hands, and I know there's going to be some questions and discussion, but just for, I want to be clear again that they were given authorization to proceed, and the program was not involved at an early phase. We weren't aware that this was going to happen, correct?
So I'll clarify that a little bit. So we were involved. We did comment on the admin draft EA.
Okay.
So we provided our standard template language in the environmental assessment. The EA went out for the final draft went out without the SET being notified. So we did not have the ability to provide any additional comments prior to the final publication, and also just working with the proponent and BLM, you know, to say, hey, or where are we with acquiring credits? Because that's the point where we probably would have considered ourselves more to say,
right,
what's the status? We found out about its publication, and then, well, actually, I think we were informed by Steve gave us a call, and that's how we found out. So that's when we started to coordinate more. But
so we gave our canned language in the admin, but when it went out for final, weren't notified, weren't involved, no changes were made, no notification was actually made to the proponent during that time period that you're going to have to do this.
Correct.
Okay. Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, unless I'm misunderstanding something, the purchase of the credits is not at the fault of the proponent. The lack of purchasing the credits, I guess, is not at the fault of the proponent. It's just that the credits have not been available.
That's not correct.
No.
There's credits available.
The whole store, the whole piece.
Yeah.
There are.
Okay.
There's plenty of credits available within the system. I think they're
okay,
working
so
with.
That's, their... that's why I asked that question, because that helps me. So then, if this is a reclamation, why is it a debit project and not a credit project?
Because we're still seeing anthropogenic disturbance in the landscape. So whether it's classified as active mining or reclamation, we still have active disturbance on the landscape associated with noise and traffic and all those things that fall into. So this is not classified as an active mining project. It's classified as an inactive mining project, which in our definitions and our policy, mines that are currently being reclaimed are classified as inactive. So they have a lower category, but they would still be analyzed in the HQT.
Thank you.
So it's important to note, though, that the credit obligation is at a lower rate than
yes.
if it was an active mine.
Yes.
About a third, probably, roughly, you're in that neighborhood.
Yeah, I Katie Anderley for the record again. I can't remember what the original calculations were, but it was, yeah, I would say less than 50% of what the
yes.
the active mine status, you know, was at the time. And through discussions, you know, with the verifier, we, in looking at the type of activity that was being conducted, you know, we made the decision that it was more appropriate to, you know, be classified as inactive rather than active. So, yeah.
So, in my mind, I, you know, I'm aware now, and I'm just thinking out loud, I guess the ideal situation in my mind would be that they purchased the third now, and if they do wish to phase those remaining two-thirds credits in, that those would be subject to that 5%. I think our policy needs to be, you know, as we just talked about in the prior
agreement to buy these credits from the party that we negotiated with. We've also, I need to go back and check, but I think part of that agreement is that we will, you know, kind of only buy from them. And the pricing that is obviously something that's part of our economic plan going forward. We have worked really hard to try and, you know, not only have these sage-grouse credits applied and developed in the agreement, but as I said, also to actually, you know, if we go forward with the agreement, have actually more sage-grouse habitat set aside than would ordinarily be required. And so what we would like to do is purchase them all in single transactions as soon as they're available, because obviously that complies with our agreement and also results in a net increase. And again, that's setting aside the idea, and I apologize, but it does set aside the idea that, you know, we're not making any money on this. This is all a cost for us. We have not operated this line. That's why we're not, that's why we have serious concerns that if we, you know, got into an actual legal discussion about this, about whether this really does apply, because what we're doing really is protection of public health and safety, and that's an express exemption under the Safe Grounds Credit statute. But again, we don't want to get involved in that, but it would be much more helpful to us if we could, purchase this in a single transaction the very second these credits are available, and we anticipate that to happen, you know, within months, not a long period of time. Our best estimate is that we would, depending on, of course, you know, some of these things are out of our control, but because it'll depend on, you know, how fast we get them approved at the state level, but we think a reasonable time frame is certainly before the end of the year, having the sage-grouse credits available since we've already started the work. But anyway, I just wanted to mention that.
Thank you. Chris?
Well, I think you touched on one of the things I didn't really want to talk about, because right, there's some merit to it in terms of reclamation, constituting mitigation. And, you know, I mean, that's a slippery slope. And it's not the same standard. I understand that reclamation is not the same standard as mitigation, but it's still an effective form of mitigation in and of itself. And the fact that they weren't notified early, I mean, of this, and in terms of charging any fee, or they've already undertaken a process, I wouldn't want this to be the rule, but it did occur in this purpose, and then we have to figure out after the fact how to shore up our regs if we can, or to ensure our communication channels are open in the future so it doesn't happen. But this unique sense, I think, in terms of, I'd like to see a contract, that an assurance of performance, if we were to agree to something like that, that they wouldn't have to have the credits up front. This is a unique situation. We don't want it to apply. We don't want it to be put in place. And maybe I'm misinterpreting them. I'm not hearing everything. So, Katie, if you have something to clarify.
I'll just add on to that a little bit. Katie Anderle, for the record. I don't know if I would go as far to say that the proponent was not aware of their obligations. They conducted the habitat quantification tool last year. So we finalized their number of debits last year, in fall sometime. So they've been working with our program for well over a year. And the regulations are out there. we may not have had specific conversations stating, the third up front particularly, but I mean, I do recall having conversations, with the CEO describing the mitigation obligations associated with state regulations and what is required of them. I mean, we had a fairly lengthy discussion. So the fact that we weren't notified of the final publication of the EA, I don't think is a reasonable excuse for them to not have been aware of their obligation. Yes, we didn't have that final last minute, hey, what's your plan for mitigation? We're getting close to the final EA, and we need to have that third mitigation done, up front prior to that authorization. So we didn't have that opportunity. However, I don't think that should be used as an excuse for proponents that have an obligation to not adhere to the regulations that that are in NAC. It's, I mean, I don't think it's our responsibility to, you know, make sure that every proponent is notified personally from us before their, you know, their final NEPA of their obligation. It's, we've been working with the proponent, we should be working with the proponent and BLM or Forest Service throughout the entire NEPA process to include that language in the NEPA, run the HDT, you know, have that obligation in the NEPA, and yeah, and then following the steps, the requirements in the regulation. So, yeah, this is a little bit of a unique situation, but yeah, I wouldn't say that because we weren't specifically in conversations with the proponent in that final NEPA stage should relinquish them of their obligation. So I don't know if Kelly wants to add any of that, but yeah, but I do agree it is, yeah, this is the first time that this has happened, so we are treading on new ground. So yeah, I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of facts involved in this, and we're almost acting like an appellate one now. So maybe you have, if you guys are looking for us for guidance versus you guys making the decision, then if the proponent doesn't like it, they can appeal it to us. So we can get a full, I mean, hearing half of what he's saying over a phone conversation, I just don't feel comfortable making something that couldn't have a determination for a lot of future things. So, I mean, are you here for us to make the decision because you're just looking for guidance, or is it, you know, or is it a decision for you to make, and maybe that's when we get into our appellate mode so we can hear the whole thing and have a more formal presentation of it. And maybe I'm being a wuss and we should just make a decision, but I feel a little uncomfortable about knowing, and some of you might know a lot more of the facts than I do.
So it would be helpful for us to have additional guidance on the next step. We have the policy that says we inform them. They try to get correct within 30 days. If they don't, then we're going to contact the BLM. We've already contacted them and made them aware that, hey, this person, this entity is out of compliance with the mitigation. It may, you know, that may lead to a request for a stop order. We would probably need some help from our DAG to try to get some enforcement from the BLM, and then the other option is, you know, they have an agreement to purchase the credits, and so really, we don't have policy that says what do we do in this situation. The only thing that we have says by the third, and then you can mitigate later, but you're going to pay a 5% penalty on that balance. And so that's where we're at from as far as the guidance that we have at this point in time.
If I could add one thing, you know, in the credit project is likely to have more credits than the project requires, but that might not always be the case if these agreements come at us in the future. There could be mitigation obligations, investment in projects that don't generate enough credits, you know, because it's hard telling not knowing until they've been quantified. But in this case, I would say, you know, the project that they're speaking of is highly, highly, highly likely to have sufficient credits to support the mitigation. Just wanted to add that thing.
Do you have any idea? Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, sir.
Chris McKenzie, for the record, do you have any idea? I mean, they haven't done a quantification of yet how many credits this would create.
They have.
Do we know?
He said on the phone that submission of the HQT package is coming next week.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Katie Enderly for the record. You know, as Kelly stated, we don't have clear policy on how to handle this situation. We have a lot of policies, you know, stating the third up front, et cetera, et cetera. I see this as really two feasible options to consider and discuss. One is what you stated, you know, ask or require of the proponent to purchase a third of the credits now to come into compliance with the regulation, and then develop a phased credit purchase agreement with us, which is the agreement that we would work with proponents to phase in the purchase of credits. Or we can consider the option to move forward with the proponent working with the credit developer to generate and acquire those credits at some future date. It is unknown when, you know, those credits would become available. There's quite a lengthy process in our QA, QC, development of the management plan, which is a fairly lengthy document and does take time. So, I mean, yes, those processes can be expedited, but it's still, it's a very involved process and it does take time. So it's impossible to say when, you know, those credits would be available, but, you know, it wouldn't be next week or next month. It would take some time. But the way I see it, I think those are probably our two most feasible options for the council to consider and offer guidance on. And I think working on additional policy to address these, you know, concerns when they come up again is something that we should look into as well. Thanks.
JJ.
Kelly, then I'll come to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kelly McGowan for the record. If my wife were here, she would probably tell me, despite your exterior, you're kind of a softy. And this is one of those cases that, you know, we don't want this to become an exception. We do not want to set precedent. But I will say that whether the full transaction of credits occurs next week or 3 months from now, that's when the term's going to begin. So they are not going to be backdated. And they still will be required to maintain those credits well after the project is finished. So there's still a 30-year term associated with them. And so there is that to consider, that yes, this is not good precedence to be setting, but I think we can develop policy to address that issue so that maybe it's handled differently moving forward. But I do take some level of comfort knowing that when the credits are purchased, that's when the 30-year clock begins. So if it's in December, it's 30 years from 2021, December 2021. So I do take some comfort in that, knowing that that the term will be satisfied. They're not going to get credit for the 6 months that they, from the time they began construction until they purchased the credit. So, anyway.
All right, one last question.
Yes, sir.
Chris McKenzie for the record, if there's an excess of credits, they're not planning on becoming, I mean, what's going to happen to those? Are they just going to be absorbed? Or?
Yeah, Katie Enderly for the record. I was going to offer some clarification on that comment as well. So the proponent is working with the credit developer to develop credits, and in all likelihood there's going to be more credits generated than the proponent needs. So that's not, however, the proponent would only be required to purchase the number of credits for their obligation. So if this credit project generated 1,000 credits and they need to buy 400 credits, then those remaining credits are available for sale to another proponent. So we're not achieving more mitigation or conservation than what would be required. Those credits would just be available to sell to another proponent.
Thank you, Chair Bevin Lister, for the record. So kind of an interesting position here for the council. And I understand the desire for guidance. I guess it would be my thought that the best guidance we could give is to take the regulations and policies that we have adopted,
use your best judgment and implement them. And then if there does come a situation where it comes back to us on appeal, then we haven't clouded or muddied the water.
Thoughts on that, Steve?
I guess I'm a little bit maybe too much like Kelly, but could one approach be that I think the first of the year was mentioned? If and we'll give them till the first of the year for all.
Get all the
for all of them
by the first
and,
of the year.
And if it's not, and if it's not, then the 5%
applies,
and then it's up to us to come up with future policy at the next meeting, hopefully, on some kind of timeline. But it was mentioned the first of the year. If that can happen, let's go with that. And if not, 5% on that, and then we're going to come up with some kind of timeline so it doesn't go on and on and on. I mean, that would be my suggestion.
Makes sense. Chris?
Yeah. I'd second that.
So it was a motion, Steve?
It was a motion, but not very clear for, but you got the gist.
It's been moved and seconded to give the proponent until the first of the calendar year, January 1, 22, to purchase the full balance of the credits. In addition, this body will work to create policy for subsequent events that will more clearly define them. As long as those credits are purchased by the first of the calendar year, there will be no 5% added. Any more discussion?
That's what you said.
Brett, does that work for you, sir?
Yes, sir, it does, and we really, we understand the unique situation. We do appreciate the consideration of council, and we will do our level best. We anticipate being able to do everything by the first of the year, but we understand the decision.
Okay. And we definitely don't want to see, you know, work stop on a reclamation service.
No,
dealing
no.
With acid and everything else. That's the last thing we want to see done. So, any more discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Chair votes aye. Any opposed? Carries.
Yep, Steve.
All right. Dan, you're back up. Update on CCS mitigation transaction and status of credit and debit projects.
Yeah, just doing another CCS update as is typical of these meetings for July 2021. And so we put some highlights in here. 17 transactions in total at this point in time. Throughout the program from the beginning, conserving nearly 18,000 acres for at least a 30-year term. We, at the last meeting, May 11th, we reported 6 mitigation transactions. We've had one since, and then we have another one about to be finalized in the near term. And these accounted for 1,400 additional acres preserved or conserved for at least a 30-year term. Also, we had 3 new credit projects, one of which was the one we just spoke to, but 2 additional ones. And so those ran the HQT this spring. And we had 2 credit projects recently signed management plans as well, moving them along. Management plan is signed, and that's when credits become eligible for sale or transfer. Also, this is a little bit preliminary. Annual monitoring is due July 31st. But we believe it's been done on every project on which the management plan has been signed. Set also visited 4 ranches, 4 or 5 year assessments, and conducted annual monitoring with the landowners. Visits were also made to have face-to-face discussions with a few landowners along the way. This was highly valuable just from a partnership perspective and discuss a bit about the program, credit sales and so forth, and it was really good from a relationship perspective with our credit producers. We have 15 potential debit projects right now representing various area industries that are, 15 potential debit projects representing various potential mitigation obligations, 8 use the HQT out in the field in 2021. So a lot of work getting done on the HQT this year. I've kind of updated the way we report out on this. We reported mitigation transactions on the second page. And so those are all the transactions to date. I believe those number 17 and will be 18 any day, as I indicated earlier. Again, 17,724 acres, 30-year terms. Credits transferred or sold, now number 4,045. We also have the credits available for transfer and those anticipated. Those the bottom are the ones without HQC results and or management plans. Again, 3 new projects this year. Those projects are Mary's River Ranch, Polk Canyon Ranch, and Little High Rock. So those are the newbies. And so those total more than 5,000 additional acres that are developing credits. Also, we try to showcase the aesthetics of the habitats. We're aiming to protect in the long run and improve. And so we did showcase some pictures of each of the projects and described a little bit about the conversations that were had on those ranches and what was done with our time out in the field. The one on AGs is not part of the credit project, that area. Those areas are typically excluded that don't have the sage grouse habitat, but it showed a little diversity and also that, start working land, associated with these ranches. And anyway, so that is not a part of this credit project.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I just wanted to add to this discussion. So on the front page, you'll see members of the set there visiting up on the mine site. This is called the Peterson Mine. It's a crystal mine. It's a very small mine, limited activity during the year, like 3 months out of the year they operate this thing. It's a lot of handwork. You do see a piece of heavy equipment. That's usually to just move the waste rock to the side, but they do a lot of handwork. They're crystals, right? They have to be very delicate. Anyway, I bring this up because we ran the HQT. It was such a small project, and we knew that the credits, because the area had been burned fairly recently, we didn't think that maybe there would even be a credit obligation associated with it. So we went out, we ran the HQT for them, but it was determined that the fire had recovered to a point where they did have a credit obligation. It was one credit that they needed to purchase. I bring this up because, and they were able to make that transaction fairly easily. It didn't require a lot of effort or paperwork or time.
So you have a tenth of a credit in the reserve account?
No, we couldn't. Fortunately, the way it worked out is, I won't go into more detail. I bring this up, I simply bring this up to say that we could have a number of these really small projects that generate very few debits. In this case, it worked out where the transaction could be done very rapidly and easily, but there may be cases where the time spent just doing the paperwork and enacting the transaction isn't worth the value of the credit. And so I think that at some point we may be coming back to you guys with a proposal to do like an in-lieu fee to where we collect. They just write us a check. We deposit the check, hang on to it when we have enough funding that we can make a transaction that would be worthy of a purchase and all the paperwork. We could do a reverse auction type of process to buy a chunk of credits with the funds that are collected. That's just one thought that I had because there are challenges
number one, we have credit producers that aren't too excited about selling one credit up because it locks up in many cases much more than one credit, because when they sell a credit from a MAP unit and that MAP unit has 30 credits within it, they lock up. Those 30 credits are still available, but they have to manage and monitor that entire MAP unit for a term. So you can see the issue that this could create. So like I say, this happened to work out, and so it all went smoothly, but I could see in the future where these types of transactions could be troubling for us to process and for them to transact and so on. So we may be bringing something to your attention that hopefully would alleviate some of these smaller purchases. We'd still get the mitigation. It'd still go on the ground, and you know, but yeah, some of these really small projects present a challenge.
A couple things to add. Dan Huser for the record. Kelly was required to wear that helmet. It wasn't just a prop. It's a picture. But in addition, it was really valuable.
I wear that in the office to protect myself.
Also, several of our visits to credit projects involved multiple generations, and it was a really nice thing to see that future generation planning to take, you know, a role and to eventually you know, take control of that project. And so that's a trend that we is pretty cool.
You need to pick your heart out up a little bit. I think it's rubbing on the top.
There's no hope there.
But, I didn't know. I didn't know if you were aware.
Every morning.
You're welcome, bud.
Other questions or comments on that CCS?
This question.
Mr. Chairman, this is Justin Barrett, if I may.
Yes, Justin.
So Justin Barrett for the record. I was curious why the timeline starts when the credits are sold rather than when the management plan is signed.
So you mean as far as the 30-year term?
Yes.
So they're running the HQT, then they're working to develop and finalize a management plan. At that point, their credits are available for sale or transfer, and they make the longer-term commitment generally when credits are sold or transferred. They can make it before, but I don't think anyone's going to speculate on a sale and make that commitment up front. There's a lot of work involved with you know, the annual monitoring, the annual reporting, verification is a costly endeavor on a 15-year rolling period. And so some of those things, Justin, they're committed. As long as they're interested in maintaining credits for sale, and they're kind of doing that from a voluntary basis until that speculative asset becomes a real asset, if you will, or and so anyway, does that make sense, Justin?
Yeah, I think that helps. Dan, we can follow up with you if we've got any more questions, but thanks for the clarification.
Okay.
It seems like a win to me. I mean, we got the credits out there in the landscape, and then at some point we're gonna lock them in for 30 years, but as long as if they sit there for 10 years, that's a win.
Right, they're reporting.
They're still reporting to you, and meeting those obligations.
And they're signing off, and they're adhering to their management plan.
Yes. Okay.
One question.
Yes, Steve.
Kelly, just, you know, again, I've asked it before, but just kind of an overview. I'm interested in the balance of supply and demand here with credits, debits, and I mean, it looks to me like we're generating quite a few credits, or we could. And the debits are kind of here. I mean, what do you see more debits, I guess, coming online, or, I mean?
Yeah, there's some have begun the process. Some are just in the scoping part of the process, but we have some fairly major power lines. You've probably heard about them from north to south, or south to north, and east to west. We also have some partial power lines that are coming out of Utah and kind of terminating in the Ely area. We have speculatively at this point some mines that are going to go into some pretty pristine areas, potentially, if they're authorized. The fortunate side on those power lines is that they will be co-located, so that's going to limit. But they're power lines; they run for long distances. So even if co-location occurs, there's still disturbance because you can't stack them on top of each other. So they're going to be offset by some distance, and that's where the debits are generally generated. And so, but if you can imagine a power line that runs over 300 miles, not all of it going through habitat, but a pretty good portion of it clipping some pretty good habitats. And that big mine, we did kind of an initial desktop analysis. It's in the tens of thousands of credits potentially needed if it goes forward. So right now we look pretty flush, but that could change fairly rapidly. One of the things that we've talked about, once we have more credit sales and we get reimbursed for what the state invested in some of these credit developers, is instead of supplying 100% of the funds necessary, we might ask them to have some skin in the game so that we have our dollars go a little further. That's one of the things that we've considered with the state funding. But we're not at that point because during the recession, some of those funds were collected for the greater good of the general fund, and so we don't have use of them. But as we get reimbursed and we have another funding round, that'll be one of the considerations that will have to be made.
Okay. Very good.
Of action items, future agenda items. But Sherm had a future agenda item of like 7 pages long. Or
I wrote it down.
You time. Wrote it down this time? Yeah. All right. So, what do we want to work on at the next meeting? And when do we want to have it?
That sounds like a full meeting.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. You know, might be, and we don't have to agree to this, but here was the idea that I voiced earlier. That we assemble information for this sort of the ask or to contemplate for an ask. And that information would be assembling information about our core habitats that we want to protect, about the needs of private landowners, the needs that would enhance sage-grouse habitat but are not fundable through the marketplace. Adaptive management and projects that are currently not funded because of there being a lack of staffing, because of there being a lack of NEPA, or because of there being a lack of implementation monies. What upcoming planning processes can be focused collaboratively for enhancing resilience of Nevada working landscapes, habitats, and ecosystems? And what questions that if we had the answer, we would change what we do as managers if only we had the science. What's the science that we need to fund? And then finally, projects recognized as needed by the local area working groups, but not yet funded.
That's a meeting.
That's it. I do have something. It doesn't have anything to do with this. Another item.
An additional meeting?
Could be. No, not a meeting.
What do you guys do?
And I've been 2 or 3 years now contemplating bringing this up, but I'm going to do it because it has been discussed informally. And what it is, it just so you know what I'm talking about, is the credit developer, when you start into this thing, you know, it can seem like a lot of money to be selling these credits for. But in actuality, in reality, if you sold $1 million worth of credits, it's very likely that $300,000 of that might go into the financial assurances or whatever, and on top of that, income tax. And that's where I'm going. Wondering if we could have this discussion about the potential possibility of some kind of conservation exemption for these monies. And I realize that's got to go to Washington, D.C., but should we, is it worthwhile to have that conversation with our representatives or a representative to see if that's even possible? And I know Kelly and I have talked about this, and I've decided not to bring it up, but I would just like to get the council's feelings on it. Is it worth pursuing? Because, you know, and like we heard, there's quite a few credits coming online. And as a potential developer, you've got to weigh all that from the 30 years to, you know, you really don't receive all those monies. There's a lot of things going on there. Anyway.
So, I think timing-wise, you're probably in pretty good shape. I mean, we look at all these initiatives that are coming out for conservation, whether it's 30 by 30, which we really don't know what that's going to look like yet, or, you know, land and water conservation. So there's obviously a focus to conserve more of this in the West. And this is probably a cheaper way than if they were to try to come and purchase.
And a direct themselves. Very direct.
It's probably a lot cheaper to just go ahead and lower or no taxes on that, as you said. So I think it's probably worth having the conversation. And now it might be very timely.
I've had a similar, Sherm Swanson for the record, I've had a similar thought for years and not known quite how to voice it, not known for sure that it was a good idea, about the ability of a generation to take a bundle of money from sale of conservation easements and protect it through something like a Roth IRA for future generations.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just a concept that I think we
can. That makes sense. I don't know if everyone is aware, Dan Huser for the record, but we did have Robert Feldman and Keiko Isom reached out and invited some of our credit producers to discuss taxes a bit. It was an hour-long webinar. We didn't have as much turnout as, and the SET wasn't a sponsor, but he did reach out, and we gave him our opponent's email information, and he reached out and had an hour-long talk, and we didn't have as much landowner participation as we like, but we do have a lot of landowners interested in, or credit producers interested in that discussion. And so in the future, if we wanted to bring that through the council.
It did come up, Dan. The tax part. It was discussed. Okay.
Yeah, that was the focus.
That was the focus.
Oh, that was
the
whole
thing. Yes,
I see. Okay.
But I don't think it was for the exemption.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't for the exemption. Yeah. It was just about tax strategies centered around credits and sales. Yeah.
So they'll charge you to watch it.
Maybe.
So I guess getting to Steve's point, is that something that this body, and you're asking if this body wants to push that forward, or do we just want to launch that out there to a representative and see what they think, or what?
I think that's maybe the place to start, is to throw it out and talk to one of them, and just I mean, we don't want to waste a bunch of time and on it, but I would like to get some feedback.
I'll just say that as someone that's working with these credit producers, this is a big thing that we don't fully understand, and I'm not an accountant. I can barely do my own taxes. and anyway, but so we can't really advise on that, and it's kind of a, you know, it's a difficulty for them to jump through that, and they don't always know prior to getting going. So it's kind of a,
if somebody's paying 25% tax and we can get it reduced to 10% or something, that's pretty major. You know, I think it's worth at least asking some questions. And maybe we should have a side meeting with some one of them or something, and just, if none of them are willing to take it on.
Got a bill already, we could tie it to. I think it might be more efficient than having to. I don't have any problem with it. I think it'd be great, give it sense. But.
Just not sure what the tax reduction bill that they would tie it to in this administration would be. But I'm just putting that out.
Undoubtedly, it'll induce bipartisanship.
Yes. Undoubtedly. So Steve volunteered to have that conversation. Is that right?
I could try to have that with the help of Kelly.
Yeah.
And some input. I will look into that if that's all right with the council.
So we don't need that on a future agenda. We're just
going to okay.
We'll look for an update on the future agenda of what you found out. How's that?
I'll do that.
All right.
And if it looks like a possibility, then an action from the body as a support board.
A letter or something, yeah. They're going to have to be brought up to speed on the program, values, you know.
Some of them are pretty well versed.
Hope so.
We'll find out.
We will find out.
But the hesitancy of landowners to sell a conservation easement is in part tied to this. Well, if I get that as a pile of money, I'm going to have to pay a bunch of taxes on it. And then future generations are not going to have the revenue source that they would have otherwise had. And so is it good for future generations if I get all this money? I think it's a broader question than just generated by our CCS.
Yeah. You and I can talk about that later.
Okay.
That's why I've not brought it up for the yeah. past 3 or 4 years. Okay.
That might be in the park.
Yeah, right.
All right, back to the agenda item.
Next week.
So I think with what Sherm's recommending, we've got quite a bit. Kelly, what do you have? Anything that we need to be working on as far as the program stuff? We're going to see that language come back that we're going to work with Justin on to make sure we're right on that one piece of policy. But is there anything else that we're going to need to do? I think we want to work on the policy of what we're going to do in our 4 steps when you don't meet that obligation to. I'd like to see that sooner rather than later so we don't do this again. It's the you will do the third up front at a minimum and 5% or whatever that looks like. Let's get that one on the next agenda.
Yeah.
Even if we have to take part assurance and roll back to another one or whatever, because I think those two pieces of policy, I don't want to do that again. I'd like to have it pretty black and white.
Sounds good. I had one other item, but I'll blame last night on not being able to recall it at this time.
Did you not sleep well?
Well, I slept well. Once I hit the bed, I would sleep well.
All right. I had one other.
Yeah, Chris.
Not necessarily for next one, but just an issue that came up kind of when we did our tour in terms of the follow-up by the agency. Mitigation occurs. I think that ORMAT, there was like a 9-year-old, something that's 9 years ago, it hadn't been done yet.
The riparian exposures, yeah, for example. Yeah.
I'm just curious to hear from the agencies if you guys have the appetite to, if you can talk them into it, but you know, as to what their policy and protocols are for ensuring mitigation occurs.
I think that kind of falls under, you know, what we talked about earlier too. Where are we going to do the work? How are we going to do it? As if we stack all that together, I think that's a key component. We got to make damn sure it gets done, because you know we can talk about it, but that's a good idea.
Yeah, and I think it'll be timely because there's still a number of projects that you guys are aware of. You know, the Gold Rock, Gold Bar. There's probably another one or two that might be out there that we've been working with for a number of years now that we're still. What their mitigation plan is and where it's going to be.
And we need to figure that out because that company, I just sent Alan an article on that as well. They just bought another mine. So
rather than just singing any old place.
Right.
And so, anyway.
When? Now, when are we going to meet?
Well, I was looking that last week of September. How does that work with folks?
There's not going to be a good time for the next 6 months, but we'll. Let's see, last week is.
Sometimes that's hard. That's
huh?
Labor Day.
NACO conference last week.
Well, last week is September.
Last week.
Last week. Last week. Okay.
What? 27, 28, 29th, or 30th?
28, 29, 30.
27th could work for me. The next 3 days are tied up.
You said the 27th, is that what you said?
Yep.
Because yeah, the rest of the week shot for us two. NACO.
I know they frequently have staff meetings on Mondays, and so that might present a challenge to do it on Monday. So maybe just as an alternate, or maybe look at some days that first full week of October.
You realize that's opening of deer season?
For some.
For a few.
Okay.
Not me. The Brown.
Actually, I don't hear where this is yet, so I can't hear it.
It's a Tuesday.
I'm not making a point here, are we?
Fifth and sixth.
I'll be somewhere else.
Fifth and sixth October are out. I've already got
Tony starts today.
Yeah. Yep.
About the seventh or eighth.
Right now it looks okay.
I will not commit to those days. I won the lottery.
Pick a date.
Okay. Let's. You guys prefer a Thursday or a Friday? Would you like to kick your meeting off with a successful SEC meeting? Let's shoot for the 8th then.
That's Friday.
That's a Friday?
Friday.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Chris said Thursday. Seven.
I won't be there.
Oh, you're honey.
Didn't Sherm say he was available?
I'm not going to be there on the 8th either.
The 1st? 7th?
Hmm. I'm going to commit that week to a different project.
Oh, okay. Well, let's shoot for the 27th, I guess.
Or the 1st.
Or the 1st?
Either end of that.
Okay. The 1st work?
I'd rather do the 1st.
October 1st.
So for 8 days. The last 3 days of October 1st.
We'll 1st. October 1st.
All right, that was difficult.
All day. I'm going to block it now, otherwise it won't happen.
Hopefully, you know, wearing a mask on the screen.
Yeah, true.
All right. Federal agency updates. Mr. Barrett, you can go first. Fish and Wildlife.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Justin Barrett, Fish and Wildlife Service for the record. Few updates. First one is the current administration and the Fish and Wildlife Service are looking to reinstate the service's 2016 mitigation policy. Locally, we really don't have any additional information at this time or any information on timeline with that, but we will keep you posted. The Fish and Wildlife Service has also been directed to develop rules regarding conservation banking for the Department of Defense's National Defense Authorization Act. We understand that this is underway, and it would be consistent with any policies put forward, but again, we're not locally engaged. Locally, however, our staff, a couple of our staff participated in the annual National Mitigation and Environmental Banking Conference this week. They said that there were many good sessions, including several on mitigation and on public lands. There's a working group developed that is working on this issue at a national level, including folks from BLM and Forest Service, working through a lot of the issues that this group, the SEC, has discussed. The other update I've got is associated with personnel. I think we probably announced it previously that our deputy field supervisor, Leanne Carranza, was moving on. She has taken a job in our regional office as our Section 7 coordinator. And so I am in the process of moving into the deputy field supervisor position, and we have hired Rachel Humans, who's formerly with the Summit Lake Paiute Tribe, to fill my role as an assistant field supervisor in our office. That's everything. Thanks.
Just a question on that NDAA. Did you say that the agency was working on banking?
The service has been directed to, it's been directed to help them develop conservation banking language and direction for the NDAA. Yeah, the National Defense Authorization Act.
Okay. Just thinking.
Other questions?
All right. Mr. Shepard, BLM.
Okay, Alan Shepard for the record for BLM. Just a few highlights for you. Still no word on the litigation with the FEISs for the sage-grouse plans. We're still following the 15 plan at this point. Got a lot of things going on with that, so still not no ruling from the injunction that was placed by the judge. Nevada and California, we're looking at initiating a plan maintenance of the 15 plan to incorporate the newer map, so we have the more recent map being used. The team has revised the half S-forms. Those are already being used this year, and they're working on updates to Table 2-2. So still some work going on with those plans. As mentioned earlier, the 2019-018, the compensatory mitigation policy, that a recent IM was issued to rescind that. That's 2021-03-038. Headquarters is working on kind of looking at all to the basis of it and how to move forward with all that stuff. So there's a lot of policy being looked at and how it can be used going forward until some decisions are made. A little bit of a fire update in sage-grouse country. Here in Nevada, we've burned so far about 3,800 acres of sage-grouse habitat, and about little over 2,200 acres of that is on BLM ground. So we're, getting a lot of fires. Small fires, but they're being put out pretty quickly. We haven't had the big one yet, like happened coming out of California right now. Knock on wood. I still think we're anticipating them because our tree country is extremely dry. That's where we expect that to happen. A lot of our other, hopefully our sagebrush country, unfortunately didn't grow very much in the last 2 years. So we don't have a whole lot of understory to carry a fire, unless it's a really wind-pushed one, I think. In regards to the half, a lot of half work going on right now, initiating some work in the bi-state country, and that's with working with California and partners, and USGS, California Department of Fish and Wildlife, Forest Service, the TAC, all those folks. So a lot of things going on there. No real change in the permit renewal process, still under litigation, all that fun stuff. Not making any advances there right now. Outcome-based grazing. Recently, with the Horseshoe Scotch Gulch, the proposed decision went out July 16th of 20, and did receive a protest, so it became final after passing and received no appeal. So that's still that one positive in the world of no litigation there. No action still on Gamble or any of the others, so still waiting on some there. Everybody's favorite, the horse and burro world. A lot of drought monitoring going on across the state, looking at condition of forage, water, animal condition, where they're moving to, not moving to. We have one emergency gather approved so far for the antelope complex in that straddles White Pine and Lincoln County. White Pine and Elko County, not Lincoln County. That's going to start sometime probably early August, depending on contracting right now. It's out with getting prices for that contract, and that's going to be a 2,200 head gather spread between four HMAs, some outside HMA country. Woodhills that, north of the Spruce Range, there's some outside country north of the Goshutes that we're going to look at, trying to solve some outside the bounds horses there that are running into some trouble, and then clean up some issues with water and spring source problems in all the mountain ranges there. So we've also, I believe we have four other requests in for emergency actions. Area around Duckwater, where we've got horses going into the tribal residence and some areas in there. We've got a private land issue down there where they're going into some hay fields in that same general area. We've got a water source problem in the Flanagan HMA above Reno in Washoe County. It's actually going onto a water that's for the water district, and they're utilizing a pond there, and they're going to fence that pond to keep them out of it. So now we have to deal with those horses leaving the HMA and breaking them down the fence to get into there. So we're going to try to get permission to solve that problem. It's pretty small, 70 head, I guess. And we've got developing, we just sent forward today a request for the Stone Cabin area down above Tonopah. In the northern half of that HMA, we've got a bunch of horses relying on water coming out of ditches from private land out to the public. That operator has been really good to keep some water coming out there to keep them horses in there. A lot of resource issues there in the sense of no growth. Horses are pretty tough condition. They're probably our toughest body condition of all the horses we've got right now. And they've declined pretty quick. I looked at pictures a month ago. They were threes or fours, but on low water. Now there's probably 20% to 30% of those horses are in condition class two, so they're dropping really fast. That's going to be a big issue. We're going to try to water trap those to take less pressure off trying to move those horses with a helicopter. But I think with that one available water, it'll be a pretty easy catch, I think. I don't think we've got anything. I think that's all of them. But we're monitoring a ton of stuff right now. There's a lot of proposals being thought about. Other areas of the Pancake Range outside of Duckwater, we're definitely looking at that. We still are on the books to do the Owyhee Complex again. It's running low on water. That whole Owyhee River system up in there is dropping like a hop rock. That thing is really decreasing in water right now. I haven't got the recent water report from there, but the pictures I saw, it dropped functionally probably a foot in depth over a course of a 3-week period of time. So the channel, or the water's going through a very small channel through the Big Canyon. And one whole HMA of horses is reliant on climbing down into that canyon to get water. But we've got other water sources that are drying up in there too. There's two big reservoirs in that country. One is completely dry. It's been dry for almost 2 months already because there's no runoff into it. So a lot of horse work going on, and all of it is, you know, unfortunately, a lot of it is in sage-grouse country, in sagebrush habitat, and there's no growth in any of it from what I'm seeing pictures and getting reports for. So that's horses. There's a proposed September 7th oil and gas sale, lease sale. It's still on the books at this point. We'll see how it goes. And that's in a number of districts, Ely, Elko. Those are the main ones. So that's happening. Kelly brought up the transmission line work. We've got a lot of transmission line things in the works. Trans Canyon from Utah to Nevada, the Robinson substation. SWIP from Idaho to the substation in Robertson. Transwest is coming at some point. That's we're still getting more information on that one. And then Green, of course, the big Green Lake projects, Green Lake West and North. West is the furthest along in development. There's a lot of work going on at that right now. The contractor for NEPA is doing a lot of field surveys, getting that work done. A lot of coordination going on with that one. That definitely will have a little bit of impact for certain in the bi-state country. And that's involving sage, and then the north version, which is from Ely over to the Urington area. That one's gonna involve a lot of sagebrush country across there in three districts, Ely, Winnemucca, and Carson City. So that'll be the next one, really kind of working through the system. But they're already out for bid on the NEPA contractor for that. So those are progressing in the NEPA front pretty quickly to get those initial surveys done. Because of the transmission lines, there's a lot of applications for solar and wind generation. Ely's getting multiple applications. Battle Mountain's getting some. Carson City's definitely getting some with these big lines coming in. So, and as well as Southern Nevada again. So we'll definitely be having lots of discussions on future work within those areas. And then probably last thing, geothermal. Again, applications. Once those big transmission lines got proposed, the applications are just funneling into all the offices, seeing where they can take advantage of geothermal resources too. So, but it's Battle Mountain's getting them, Carson, Elko, Ely, Winnemucca. It seems like everybody. Southern Nevada's, I think, the only one that doesn't have geothermal. they're out of that realm at this point.
Well, they're going to sit a bucket of water outside. Geothermal.
they're the fortunate ones.
But so what you've got to have is water that's hot in comparison to the air temperature.
Yeah. They could just put the bucket of water out, let it heat up, and then run it through the mill, through the system. So yeah, but I think that's the main highlights of what's happening right now for us. Any questions?
You mentioned a lot in that pancake going on down there. What's the status of that EA on that together?
It is out.
Mm-hmm.
It was appealed and asked for a stay by Wildland Defense and Wild Horse Education. And recently the judge denied their stay. So it's in effect. So when and if we can get the space funding and permission to do something in there, that one's in effect. But the litigation will continue on hearing for the merits. But yeah, that we just got that word just the other day.
Now, is it your 7-year or 10-year plan on that one?
It's a 10.
10, okay.
We're writing almost everything now to at least 10 years or some variation of that to make sure that we can do multiple gathers over multiple years without having to issue new decisions.
That's a lot of sore spots down there, you know.
Yes.
Just a quick question. Alan, you mentioned something about a change in the half. Is it just a change in the form?
Yes.
I'm not sure I understood.
It's just a change in the form of how it's used and clarified.
So I'm really glad to see the longer duration for the gather EAs, because doing one for each gather makes no sense at all. It seems to me that we ought to do that for a duration long, until we need a revision, so that if you do it an EA and gathering to AML is the way forward, and you've got the EA permission to gather the EA, why does it ever wear out? Until you decide that the AML, excuse me, is not right, and then you do another one. But if that's, you know, 5 years, fine. If it's 25 years, fine.
Right. Well, in the NEPA world, in reality, a decision is effective until the authorized officer makes the decision that there is a change warrants new NEPA. When we developed, when our solicitor and myself first initiated this in Nevada a number of years ago, we worked through the process and tried to come up with language that we felt that we could get, which is a bad word, support from the advocates, in the sense that it wouldn't be this long, could be 20-year document or 30-year document, where we put a little bit of a lifespan to it to be able to say, we're gonna use this document how many times we want over this time period to get to AML and to achieve AML and maintain it, and to implement fertility control and maintain it. That was our key language that we put into it, because in the past, we wrote all of our documents that we're just gonna get to AML and we're gonna do fertility control. But we didn't, in those previous ones, and I'm trying to remember when we wrote the actual language into it exactly, but it was 7 or 8. It was when we started it, and then Nancy and I finished it we wanted to take it out of that realm of a one-hit wonder document. And by putting in the achieve and maintain allowed it to have longevity. Because we can get to AML and it might take us 2 or 3 events, but we want to maintain it too. And so by having the maintain language into it allows us to take it, you know, yeah, we achieved AML, but we're going to maintain it now by doing this gather again. So 2 years after maybe getting to AML, we can do and take off a few animals again and get it back into that conformance of that AML.
But if you have an EA that has a 10-year time span and you get to year 12 and you need to maintain, but you don't have a new EA, what happens then?
Well, there's at that point, there's still the possibility that it can be a determination of NEPA adequacy, because if conditions haven't changed, you know, to support a change of AML, for example, you know, conditions out there on the range, there's more forage or more water or whatever it happens to be, we can definitely look into that avenue. But also, we also have that pre-existing document that would serve as a quick update to it to put it out again. But, you know, we haven't reached the lifespan of one yet that we've issued in you know, 10 and 11. The Oahe, this is the last year of the Oahe. We wrote that one in 11. And so it's our test. You know, so we're gonna gather one last time this year. and then we're going to have to reissue and make a decision of how NEPA is handled for the next period of time. So it's, you know, we're fast approaching the time of when we got to do some of those updates.
So one other question about horses. The research that I've been involved in found that the cows were using meadows 30 times more than per acre than the rest of the allotment, but horses were using those meadows 50 times more than the rest of the allotment or the rest of their herd management area. So it's a real concentration area for horses. And also in the 2010 Wild Horse and Burro Management Handbook, it for the first time specified that riparian PFC is one of those criteria for this thriving natural ecological balance. And of course, that's RAC standard for grazing of livestock. And the RAC in 2006-ish voted all three RACs to have the livestock standards and guidelines be applied to wild horse and burro management. Do they actually apply to wild horse and burro management? Is the PFC requirement operative? And if so, how is the BLM getting that PFC assessment or the monitoring in the adaptive or integrated riparian management seven-step process, that monitoring done to make that actually work?
Well, I think in any, as we develop any of our NEPA, the gather plans and the NEPA associated NEPA, all that's being looked at to help justify, you know, the resource conditions that we're stating are is in decline or in immediate potential harm. So, you know, I think all that monitoring, regardless if it's, you know, riparian or upland monitoring, use patterns, any of those things, as well as movement patterns, are a key part of support for our proposed action. So it definitely, you know, we always try to identify, you know, we're losing condition at resource at riparian areas due to, you know, significant use there, plus the population numbers themselves, animal condition. You know, our biggest, you know, one of our biggest drivers is just trying to handle the horses as the population goes of them moving, you know, and going into stuff that they're not supposed to, you know, leaving the HMA or going back into, you know, going on the private lands and stuff. So, you know, some of our key supportive aspects of managing horses is identifying those private lands that are being impacted, you know, public health and safety, animal conditions, riparian issues. You know, I think we probably need to do a much better job in some of our documents on you know, sagebrush habitats, you know, how we're impacting some of that stuff, you know, better than we're doing right now. So we're trying to make these as solid as we possibly can over the different issues, and it's just getting the guys in the field to do the monitoring, get that monitoring on paper, so it can be used to support if we get challenged.
Okay, we're gonna move on because we're kind of exceeding the scope of an update.
Yeah.
we're getting into an agenda item that is not agendized.
So my last question.
Thanks. Okay. Thanks, Alan. Mr. Brown, you're up, sir.
You wanna talk about horses?
Thank you, Chairman. Lance Brown for the record. I do have a...
Oh, Christ.
I do have just a... You know, we're talking about, you know, as mentioned about drought. We're in the midst of a drought, and it's multi-year. It's impactful. And so, you know, that's, you know, so we're working with our permittees, collaborating with them on trying to have sustainable operations as well as care for the resources. And so we are having some issues with some of our horse territories. In Central Nevada, adjacent to Stone Cabin, you know, outside of Tonopah, you know, we are focusing some attention to the herd there, and body condition is declining, and water availability is very limited, and so it's an ongoing thing we're beginning to monitor and catch up with the BLM. And so, also with drought, you know, we're spending a lot of time talking about the fire system and fire suppression and fuels management, and you know, support for fire suppression has been a priority for the agency, and so it's all hands on deck you know, support that endeavor for sure. I do have just a couple of updates with respect to organization and just some staffing. And so during this last hour, I believe we have a new chief that's being sworn into the Forest Service. And so, you know, Randy Moore, who is a Region 5 regional forester, will be our new chief. And just a little bit of leadership shift and changes or vacancies that we have on the HT. We have three line officer positions that are going to be open. So Bridgeport Ranger District, Santa Rosa Ranger District, and out of Elko in Wells. So we got a deputy district ranger vacancy that's going to be occurring there. And I guess just another positive on the staff. Staffing is that we were able to fill a hydrologist for the forest as well as an ecologist. And so those positions are based out of the supervisor's office, but provide great support to all the districts. And so we're thankful we're starting to get some of the resource position staff. And so that's it in your report.
Sure. Ray, Mr. Dodson, are you still on?
No, Ray's not on, but I'm Jared Evans, and I will give this report.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, this is Jared Evans, NRCS, Nevada.
Jared. Okay, Jared.
Thank you. And Ray Dodson, he wanted to thank all of our partners. We have published our state strategy for the Working Lands and Wildlife Initiative. That includes two species, sage grouse and also southwestern willow flycatcher. But the vast majority of our money in that goes to sage grouse because there's such limited habitat for southwestern willow flycatcher in Nevada.
Hey, Jared, real quick. Maybe if you're on speakerphone, if you can come up, we're not hearing hardly anything you're saying on this end for some reason. We got a bad connection.
I'm on my computer using Jabber. You can't hear me?
No, we can barely hear you at all.
Okay, I'll try calling back in on my cell phone.
Okay.
You can call to the next person, and I'll give my report after I...
Okay, that'll work. Well, just give me a holler when you get back on.
Okay, thank you.
All right, let's go to state agencies while we're waiting for that. Office of the Governor, I don't think... Office of the Governor, is anybody on the phone? There's nobody here. Okay. DCNR, we're going to just skip that one. Means they both left. They didn't like us. That's fine. Alan?
I'll let Sean kind of tie in. As has been mentioned, it's a drought. We are realizing it very much. We have water sources going dry, stress of wildlife. And we're dealing with that not only in the conditions on the range, but on our fisheries. And so while there's a benefit in not having wildfire, we're dealing with the drought. And Sean is up at the table, so I'll let him kind of fill us in on what he's got. I may tie in on the back end.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Sean Espinosa with the Department of Wildlife for the record. I just wanted to update the council on where we're at with sage grouse select counts. We're still working through the data currently. We just got USGS data a couple of weeks ago, or actually a week ago. But we have currently over 2,000 observations of lecs this year, as opposed to about 760 last year. So we're out of the COVID period of dark days of not being able to survey. So we got a good number of lec observations this year. As you may already know, we actually closed 10 hunt units this year to sage-grouse hunting, and we reduced season length pretty drastically throughout the state. Northwestern Nevada, we actually reduced that season length to just a two-day season, so pretty drastic changes there. Also, for the council's information, we have developed a sagebrush obligate species priority area map that we'll be sharing with the technical team. That map incorporates a pygmy rabbit habitat model that was developed by UNR. Also, the sage-grouse priority area maps, the breeding density areas for sage-grouse, Lahontan cutthroat trout, streams with a 1 mile or 1 kilometer buffer, as well as mule deer, important mule deer habitat and pronghorn habitat. And then something else that we're thinking about integrating into that is one of the things that we're seeing, and I'm sure you noticed it yesterday on the field tour, is we're seeing quite a bit of sagebrush die off, trying to figure out a way to remotely sense that and catalog that on the landscape and perhaps bring that into that priority area map for consideration. So that's it.
Questions?
I'll add, we just wrapped up the WAFWA meetings, and we've alluded to it a couple times. Is WAFWA is the 17 western states and provinces, wildlife agencies, and they get together. And as we described earlier, one of the things that they're working on is this sagebrush conservation strategy as part of the Sagebrush Executive Oversight Committee. There is a pretty comprehensive scientific part one that is already out there. We'll send you guys that link and make sure it's shared, but it'll be a big piece which we'll lean on. And as I mentioned before, USGS and US Fish and Wildlife Service are, you know, providing a bunch of input into that process, as well as all the state agencies. And so I think it'll be a good thing that as we go into this prioritization piece, it'll be something that we can go to those places and tap into that information. Other things as far as this year, while we haven't seen the wildfire, again, knock on wood, is that we are, and now is currently, getting ready to go buy seed for things that we did last fall, last winter. We actually treated about 30,000 acres with herbicide to chemically fallow it. And so we've seen great success with that. So we'll be reseeding that. So despite, while we haven't seen much as far as burns this year, we've already got work slated from what we carried over from last year. So that's all I've got. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. Jared, did you rejoin us?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yep. That's better. Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. Sorry, Ray. Had to stop, step off for another meeting. You just wanted me to convey that we've released our Working Lands for Wildlife State Strategy. It's a five-year strategy, 2021 through 25. We would like to thank our partners that helped with that. We wanted to thank Nevada, and this isn't limited to, this is just the list I have, and there's probably other people that contributed, or other agencies. The Nevada Conservation District, Bureau of Land Management, Humboldt, Tuolumne National Forest, and Nevada Department of Wildlife all contributed to this Working Lands for Wildlife State Strategy. And that's for two species, for the sage grouse and for southwestern willow flycatcher. The bulk of the money is going to go to the sage grouse, though, because we have limited habitat for southwestern willow flycatcher habitat in Nevada. I have a PDF copy of that. If people want a copy, a PDF copy, they can email me at Jared, J-A-R-R-O-D, Edmunds, E-D-M-U-N-D-S, at usda.gov. We also have published copies that are glossy at our state office, and also we sent copies to our field offices if you want a glossy copy.
We have copies of those here. They were handed out. Thank you.
Oh, okay, great. As we're right in the middle of our contracting season, we got a little over $8 million for our environmental quality incentives program this year, and so far we've obligated about $5 million worth of those money. There's 56 contracts we've obligated so far. Of that, there was 6 SGI projects that were pre-approved for $323,000. And I also would like to share that we are hiring. We're trying to expand our staff so we can get conservation on the ground. And we have soil conservationist positions in all of our field offices that is open, a range management specialist in Winnemucca, an engineer in Winnemucca, and soil conservation technicians in 4 of our offices. That's out on USA Jobs right now, and it closes on August 4th. And those are entry-level positions. And the soil conservation technicians don't require a college degree, so we're hoping to get local talent on those jobs. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Any questions, Ruth Redmond? Okay, thank you. Ms. Jepson, Department of Agriculture. Good morning, afternoon.
Feels like a little bit of both.
What's that?
Feels like a little bit of both.
Yeah.
For the record, Ashley Jepson with the Nevada Department of Agriculture. Just, I have a few things, and I will honestly be brief, so be reassured. So a couple of things I just wanted at the forefront of your minds, and I think a couple of these things have been mentioned in the past, but we did, as part of our weed-free program, we did adopt weed-free mulch. At this point in time, we've been doing gravel pits and forage, so you guys are taking on projects, just keep that in mind that we do have that as an option to help with some of our weed mitigation in the state. We did graciously receive some funds from BLM some time ago, frankly, to help with source ID and working with our producers to boost our local supply of native seed. We are onboarding staff right now to actually be the boots on the ground rather than staff that are wearing a number of different hats. So I think we'll be seeing a lot of traction in the coming months on that. One big shout out to Deputy Administrator Megan Brown is we did have a multi-agency early detection rapid response discussion with our federal and state partners, really highlighting what we're doing with some of our mapping, verifying site locations, and really with the goal of choosing some of those Class A populations that we can put forward some funding that we do have for some of our noxious weeds treatment to be most effective for those Class A critical species. Trying to work effectively and multi-jurisdictional on some of those projects. So we're making good traction on that, and hopefully we'll be selecting some projects here in the future that we can report on. That's it.
Questions? Yes, thank you. Conservation District Program. Melanie Stalonzo, maybe. Hello? All right, maybe not. Okay, we'll move on. Public comment. Public comment on the telephone. Any public comment in Eureka? Entertain a motion to adjourn.
One thing.
I didn't ask for one thing.
We had a really good tour. Thank you, barbecue. Can we help donate for some of the expense?
Nope.
Sure.
We're good. Yep. I'm just glad somebody came.
Yeah,
it was awesome. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Needed that. Was. All right.
Thank you.
I'm ready for grease and bubbles.
Prove you're still alive.
Yeah. Still alive. Is there a motion to adjourn now?
So move.
Sure. Seconded by Mr. Boyce. We're out of here.
If you guys can return your travel claims to Kathleen, that'd be awesome.
Yeah,
we'll make sure you get paid.
If you think about it.